with Mama Monster. That's how stupid. I can't help it.
This. I'm gonna keep the recording until you say it. So.
Okay, wait a minute. I gotta compose.
You've got to get through it, or we're never gonna be able to do this.
I have to compose myself. Wait a minute.
Jesus.
Okay. Hey, this is Mama Monster, and you're listening to the Solo Monster Sounds Off.
Ooh, I'm enjoying the commentary today. Ooh, ooh. Oh, my God. Ooh, ah, ooh, ah. Ooh, ah. Ooh. Ooh.
Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, tang, walla, walla, bing, bang. Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, tang, walla, walla, bang, bang.
Ooh.
Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, tang, walla, walla, bing, bang.
Ooh.
Oh my God! I told the witch doctor I was in love with you.
Ooh.
I told the witch doctor I was in love with you.
Ooh.
And then the witch doctor he told me.
I'm enjoying the commentary today. Ooh. 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 Oh my God. Ooh.
Wait a second, wait a second, wait a second. There's nothing about Monday Night Raw that is fun. It's business time, baby.
The Solo Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me!
Delete! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Commentary is just, it's so awful. Every Monday, oh my God. But hey, at least we can amuse ourselves in some small way. That was one of the more enjoyable parts of Raw Monday Night, was making fun of it. This is episode 599 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off, here for Mother's Day Sunday, May 12, 2019. I am the Solo Monster. I want to wish a very happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there listening, of which I know we have many. We have a lot of ladies out there, believe it or not, who do pay attention to wrestling podcasts, who do sit through the same shows that you and I sit through each and every week, and that's on top of doing their motherly duties. I don't know which is harder, frankly. I don't know which is worse, raising a kid or sitting through Monday Night Raw. I think it's kind of debatable at this point. But thank you for tuning in. We are, of course, 1 week away from episode 600, actually less than a week away. I will be broadcasting live on YouTube for the first time in almost 2 years. I did those two live shows in 2017, and then we had something of a drought last year. I wanted to do something special for the 600th episode, and so I said, well, we were on YouTube for 500, so why not 600? And we're going to do Money in the Bank predictions. We've got Double or Nothing coming up. We've got phone calls to take. There's going to be a lot to talk about, including something else that's going to be airing this week, which I'll get to in a second. So hope everybody can tune in live. If not, it will be archived on the YouTube channel after, and I will be pushing that show out to the feed as normal next Sunday. But to listen live, you got to tune in on Friday night, May 17th, this upcoming Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern. Just go to the YouTube channel, and you can stream the show live starting at 9 o'clock. Hope to see you all there. Spread the word, let people know. You can also support the podcast in a number of different ways. You can keep using our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Now, a lot of you have cashed in on various wrestling books. You've sent me tweets and emails about the books that you've gotten. And look, if you cash in on a book that's really, really good, even if it's not wrestling related, let me know about it, because I want to let other people know. Maybe they want to download the same thing. And the best part about the trial is that even if you cancel before the 30 days are up, That book belongs to you. Nobody can take that away from you. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster. You could also make a PayPal donation, as always, on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. If you would like to get a shout-out on episode 600 live, just make sure you get those donations in by or before Friday this week. If you miss the Friday cutoff, it won't be good until the next show, whenever that is, because I'm going to be in Vegas the following weekend, and I'm not sure if I'll even be able to do a show that weekend. So just make sure you get those donations in if you are sending one in for the special 600th episode by or before this Friday, so that you can get a live shout out on the show, live on YouTube. How about that? But I want to say thank you this week to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Luis Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Better Than Raw Robert Michalshek. I think an ingrown toenail would be better than Raw at this point. Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Ryan the Dagger McTaggart, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, Critical Condition Kevin Smith, Dashing David Vera, Interfere and I'll Kill You Ingo Wabu, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep. Hopefully he can do a new dance for me here for my 600th episode. Hey, I'll tell you what, if he does a new dance for the 600th episode and wants to record it, I might play it. On the, I was going to say, I'll play it during the live YouTube show, but then again, if there's actual music attached to it, it'll probably be flagged, so maybe that isn't such a good idea. But anyway, Recon Russell Bulware, Kingmaker Christos Kalantzis, and the all-time great Armando Lopez, who's been a long-time listener, so thank you to everybody who made a contribution this week. I greatly appreciate it. I want to give a shout-out to Chris Van Vliet, who did a great interview. I'm sure some of you at least have seen it by now, but if not, you're missing out. He did this great interview with Rhino, whose WWE contract expires on July 17th, kind of like CM Punk's all those many years ago, July 17th. And he has said that he will not be re-signing. He told Chris in the interview that he was offered a deal to re-sign by WWE for twice the amount of money that he is making now, because they are throwing money at people like never before to keep them under contract. And he still said no. He has no ill will. He has no bad blood with the company. He says they've treated him well, but he doesn't want to just be paid to sit at home. And that's his biggest fear. He'll sign probably one of these five-year deals. And for Rhino, that could, look, I mean, at the stage of his career, you never know, that could be the last contract he ever signs, although he did tell Chris in this interview that he'd love to keep wrestling for about, I think, 8 more years. He was very specific in how many more years he'd like to wrestle. But his fear is that he would just be paid to essentially sit at home, which sounds like a great deal to a lot of people, I'm sure. But he made it very clear in this interview, he loves being on the road. He loves driving. And he wants to be out there. He wants to work independent shows all over the place. He wants to be able to not just wrestle, but he wants to be able to teach and recruit new people. If he sees a diamond in the rough somewhere at some indie show, someone he thinks has great potential to be the next WWE star or Ring of Honor star or All Elite Wrestling star, he wants to be that guy who helps those people and recruits them and does all that stuff. And he did admit that he feels part of the reason that, and this is coming from a WWE contracted star. This is not, these are not just people and fans on the internet saying this for all the people who love to toss the whole t-shirt company insult at AEW. Rhino himself admitted that he feels part of the reason that WWE is throwing all of this cash around right now, guys like him, is because they want to tamp down on another competitor. They don't want to give that other promotion legs to grow. And they don't want to be in a situation like they were many years ago with WCW. You know, and this is coming from somebody on the inside who received an offer and was probably thinking to himself, gee, I wonder why they're offering me all this money. It's pretty obvious. But he seems very content with life right now. He ran for local office last year. I think he won the primary. He lost in the election. He is likely to run again, so he, much like Kane, who ended up becoming the mayor of Knox County, you know, he's got political aspirations. So I'm sure we'll see him running for office more in the future. So, you know, he's got his own boat. I think he owns his own marina, you know, down there up in Michigan, and he wants to work the independent scene. So he says he's open to going to AEW. He's open to going to Ring of Honor, but he really just wants to get out there and wrestle and work. And there's just no guarantee of that with WWE. And yet another example, like the Revival last week, I talked about this, that money is not always the end-all be-all. And if you are doing okay money-wise and you've saved, as it seems Rhino, you know, has, and he's been smart with his money, as you get older, you get to call your own shots, and you don't feel like you need to sign just because they're throwing a bunch of money at you. You know, you're working from a position of power that WWE is not used to. They're not used to these people saying no. They're not used to those two little letters. N-O. No. They're not used to hearing that from people. You know, WWE has a lot of problems right now that they just cannot throw money at and expect to fix. And that is what has to scare them to death about a new competitor gaining any traction, is that if someone gets TV, good TV, great TV, and they've got some money behind them, they don't have as much leverage all of a sudden as they've enjoyed since WCW went under almost 20 years ago. So, good for Rhino. He seems like a great dude. It was a fun interview. That's only a snapshot. It was about 40 minutes long. Everybody should go watch it. I think Chris does the best interviews in wrestling right now. Got a sad story here to kind of open on. Lucha Libre star Silver King, real name Cesar Barón, who you may remember from his appearances in WCW in the late 90s. He was brought in to participate in the cruiserweight division. He was a part of that. He also wrestled for AAA, CMLL, any really major promotion of any kind down in Mexico. He died in the ring yesterday at the age of 51 while working a match against Juventud Guerrera, another WCW cruiserweight alum, for the Lucha Libre World promotion. This was not a show in Mexico. This was a show in the UK. This was in London. And this story and the video and everything just brought back bad memories of Misawa's death in the ring in Japan many years ago. Actually, it might have been 10 years ago, actually. I want to say it was 2009 when he died in the ring. And Perro Aguayo Jr. dying in the ring a few years ago. He was a lot younger than Silver King was. But I did see the video that was posted in some places online. I wanted to see for myself what the hell happened here. It's not something I would post a link to or anything like that. And this was really tough to watch because, not just because of what happened, knowing now in hindsight, but this was maybe worse than any of the other things I've seen because so much time went by after it became obvious that something was wrong with this guy. You know, it looked like he suffered a heart attack. I don't know that that's what some people are saying and some outlets are reporting, but I don't know that that is an official diagnosis. It sure looked like this guy may have had a heart attack in the ring. He was clearly having some kind of medical episode, and neither Juventud nor the referee picked up on it. You know, the last move that he hit was a flying clothesline off the ropes on Juventud. Juventud kicked out when Silver King went for the pin. And it was around then that things really became obvious. Okay, something is wrong here. He started acting very strangely. He was on all fours when he tried to get back up to his feet. He couldn't. He didn't have the strength. He was sort of, you know, rocking back and forth. He was trying to get up, but he just couldn't do it. And that's when Juventud delivered a running kick to the chest. He sort of just backed up and hauled off and kicked him in the chest like he was kicking a punt in a football game. And Silver King just fell face flat, and that was the last time that he moved. After that, he did not move a muscle. He was just face down, prone on the mat. Now, Juventud tried to roll him over to make the cover. I think he was talking to the referee and trying maybe to get the referee to just stop the match. The referee, you know, wouldn't. Juventud was trying to roll him over. It was just dead weight at that point. And it just, you know, he was started smacking him on the back. And I'm watching this and I'm going, you know, precious seconds are ticking away as this is happening. And, you know, look, at first there's some confusion. You don't know right away necessarily, but, you know, look, I'm a fan watching video of this and it was pretty freaking obvious to me that something was wrong here. So finally, he gets him over onto his back. The referee starts counting. He holds up the count at 2.5 because he probably figures, well, this is not supposed to be the finish. And then finally, he smacks the mat for the 3 count, and they ring the bell and play Juventud's music. And meanwhile, Silver King is laying in the ring, you know, in a bad way, unconscious, immobile, and just in a bad way. And it was almost a full 2 minutes that went by before Juventud finally got the pin. 2 minutes went by in the meantime. Now, this guy has a mask on, which makes it harder to just look at his face and know for sure if something is wrong. But again, I'm not encouraging people to go seek out the video, but take my word for it. You watch this, and it's obvious that something is wrong. And to make matters worse, as the music is playing, it's another 90 seconds. I counted it out. It's another 90 seconds before anyone even comes into the ring to check on this guy. The referee is standing there. He doesn't know. He probably doesn't know his own name, this guy. He didn't seem to know where he was. But it was 90 seconds before anybody else even slid into the ring to check up on Silver King. That's 3.5 minutes gone. Right off the bat, 3.5 minutes. Who knows if that could have made the difference for him between life and death? We just don't know. Maybe it wouldn't have mattered. But that's just a horrible way to go. With nobody realizing what's happening, you're underneath this mask. Lord only knows what he was experiencing. I'm sure it wasn't pleasant, whatever it was. He was clearly struggling. And for so much time to go by like that. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare scenario. Something like that should never, ever happen again. And there were people saying, well, that's Mexico for you. They have unregulated shows in Mexico. It wasn't in Mexico. This was in London. That's what people didn't, you know, a lot of people don't realize. This was not a show held in Mexico. This was held in London. You know, fans on Twitter who were at the show, one after the other, tweeting out, the response was so slow. I can't believe, you know, it took this long for medical personnel to get down there and get into the ring. Slow to respond, slow to respond. Multiple messages like that I saw. They also used the defibrillator, you know, panels on him in the ring to no avail. There should, at the very least, it would seem to me, be referees who are trained to spot this sort of thing, get some basic degree of medical training and are able to spot things like this and take the appropriate measures. Stop the match, call for the bell, wait for some medical personnel or an ambulance or something. It took another, I think, 20 minutes for an ambulance to even arrive at the building. Now, they did at least cancel the rest of the show. This was not the main event. So the rest of the show was canceled, but just a horrible situation. And 51 is still too young. 51 is still too young for anybody to go, especially like that. But nothing like this. This should be a lesson here for promotions all over the place, not just over there or in Mexico or here in the States, but anywhere. I don't care how big or small the show is. You know, they may not have the financial means to staff it up with doctors at ringside and things of that nature, but you know what? That might not be a bad investment to make. But at the very least, Your referee, and this was not some random person, my understanding is this was a fairly experienced referee, should have had the common sense enough to spot that something was wrong and take action and not just stand there like, you know, he's in some kind of strange land and doesn't know where the hell he is. There's just no excuse for that. Tomorrow night, after Raw, WWE will be airing a special on the network called The Holy Grail, the search for WWE's most infamous lost match. Talking about the Bret Hart-Tom McGee match. Are you sick of hearing about Tom McGee yet? Are you sick of Tom McGee fever? Because it's starting up again. This is, of course, about the Bret Hart-Tom McGee match from 1986. And the special will also delve into what happened to Tom McGee after that, why his star burned out, what has happened to him since. When I talked about this several weeks ago, I mentioned the fact, I think it was last year, he was physically assaulted And I think I may have mistakenly said it was up in Canada, which I think is where he is from. This may have happened in California. I don't know if it happened in Canada or not, but yeah, there was a commotion outside of his home with a bunch of kids. They may have been defacing property or a car. He came outside, and it was about six kids, I think, and they beat the shit out of him. I mean, he was really messed up badly, and so I take it he's doing better now. But anyway, they'll have a whole update on McGee on this special. It's like a little mini documentary, I guess, that WWE has assembled here. And they will also, at the end of this documentary, be airing the match in its entirety. So anybody still wondering, hey, are they going to show just clips of the match, the actual match? They will be airing the match in full for the first time ever. And this is all after a fan who also was a wrestling photographer for many years and became friendly many years ago with Bret Hart. She had come many years ago, maybe a decade ago or more, into possession of Bret's collection of VHS tapes, his personal collection. He needed somebody, and somebody recommended her for it, to help convert them over, I believe, to DVD. And she obviously still has either all of Bret's tapes or some of them. She has them in bags, garbage bags in her closet. She was cleaning stuff out. Actually, I don't know if she was cleaning stuff out or there just may have been some kind of debate about the match. And she happened to go through and found the VHS that Bret had been in possession of. And WWE either gave him the master. I can't imagine they would have just handed him over the master copy, the lone copy that they had. It's possible, I suppose, but either that or they lost their own copy of it in their archives. And this woman had this VHS cassette just sitting in a bag for years in her closet. Now, it was mislabeled. It was sort of labeled to make you think it was a different Bret Hart McGee match that they had in 1989. It was not. It was the match that people have talked about for years. Wrestlers, I think Colt Cabana's told the story that when he was in developmental, you know, guys can go and ask, they can request for a particular tape to be pulled from the library that they want to watch, that they want to study. And I think it was Cabana who had requested that match many years ago and was turned down. And I don't remember if they gave him an excuse, if they just said no, if they said we don't have it. But he did not get to see the match, and it was believed that, well, maybe it just didn't exist on tape anymore. You know, it's one of those forbidden tapes that nobody will ever get to watch, and then this happens. It's just one of those random discoveries. And so WWE regained possession of it. Obviously, they badly wanted this tape back because they saw all the commotion about it. All people were talking about for weeks was the stupid Bret Hart-Tom McGee match. And so I don't know if there was a negotiation. She, as best as I can remember, she said she would be willing to just hand the tape over to them since it technically belongs to them anyway. I don't think that she had to hold them up for ransom or anything like that. So she gave them the tape back. They have it in their possession. They put this documentary together on short notice. This is the match where Bret made Tom McGee look so good that Vince McMahon practically wet himself backstage, thinking that he had found himself his next world champion. Post-Hogan, he had found the new Hogan. This was back in 86, when Hogan was still was at his peak of popularity. And he thought that he had found the second coming, until he saw him wrestle pretty much everybody else on the roster. Although I have seen clips of some matches that McGee had with, you know, Ted DiBiase and Arn Anderson. And he didn't look exceptionally bad in those matches, but boy, he must have looked like $1 million in there with Bret. And that's why people are so curious to see what this match looks like. Does it live up to expectations? Probably not. I don't think it could. I think people are going to go into this thinking, man, I've heard about this match so much, it must be a five-star classic, and when they see that it's not, they're going to be severely disappointed. I don't know that anybody ever said it was a five-star classic, but the whole thing about the match is, it's just an example of why Bret Hart is so damn great. And you know what? I don't need another example of why Bret Hart is the greatest of all time. I already knew that, but now everybody else will get to see why. So we'll get to see what all the fuss is about on Monday, and I will get to talk about this match, that means, on episode 600. You know, and StarCast is having its own panel in Vegas with Bret Hart and Tom McGee, where they talk about the match. They will not be airing the match, and I don't recall that ever being advertised by Conrad or StarCast at all. I don't know where, you know, people were getting that from, that it was confirmed they would actually be airing the match. It's just a panel. They're going to talk about it. Now, you know, is WWE doing this to screw with StarCast? I know some people are saying that. Honestly, I think they would be doing this regardless of StarCast, because they just gained possession of this tape probably in the last few weeks. And here's the reason why I think this would be happening regardless of whatever Conrad may be doing. They know that this match, this footage, is already out there. It's in the hands of some wrestlers. Davey Boy Smith Jr. somehow got a copy of it a few weeks ago. He tweeted out a clip, like a 10-second clip from the match, like a little teaser. He's like, I have it. I have it in my possession. Frickin' Cheeseburger has the match. Cheeseburger! He tweeted a clip of this match out. Cheeseburger. I don't think WWE wants people like Cheeseburger to get the scoop on them. They don't want to be scooped by Cheeseburger. You know, and or take the risk that one of these days, someone is just going to post the damn thing on Daily Motion. So I think they just wanted to get this done as quickly as possible. They rushed this thing out, and they want people to come to the network, and they want them to watch it on the network instead. I mean, you can call this company petty about a lot of things. This, though, I think was going to happen regardless of whatever Conrad may have had planned. All Elite Wrestling made the announcement this week that Double or Nothing will air live on ITV Box Office in the UK, which is a pay channel, from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. with the buy-in pre-show. That's what they're calling their pre-show, buy-in. The pre-show will air at midnight on ITV4. And I know ITV is a huge network over there. It's where World of Sport aired. It's where I did my interview about Burt Reynolds on their morning show last year. If you missed that story, you can go back in the archives and listen to that. But I had one of you guys tweet me also to say that ITV4 is pretty far down the pecking order over there. As far as the channel order or channel lineup is concerned. Even still, you would have to think that if this stuff does well enough, if they could get their TV show once it launches on the proper main ITV channel, that would be a huge deal over in the UK. And the UK is still, I mean, maybe things have cooled a little bit, but, you know, there's still a lot of great wrestling over in the UK, and the UK wrestling scene is still very strong, and so there may well be great interest in seeing the show over there, and if they can get a good slot on a good network, that can make all the difference in the world. It's all about accessibility and access. Well, I guess that's the same thing. But that's really the most important thing. And I don't know what kind of negotiations they already have going on. They may be in negotiations with ITV right now as we speak and other networks over there. But a great showing here, I think, would go a long way for AEW. Now, speaking of a big deal, that leads to the other big announcement. JB, listener of the show, tweeted me, and shout out to JB. He tweeted me after the ITV news broke on Wednesday, and he asked me if I knew when they would be making an announcement about where people could watch the show in the US. He said, "Dude, this is great for the UK, but what about us? What about domestically? Any news?" And, of course, at that point, there was no news to report. My answer to him, what I tweeted back at him with, was that this coming Wednesday are the TV upfronts for all the major networks here in the States. And if the pay-per-view announcement somehow ties into their new TV deal, like a streaming deal, then that is probably where they're going to make the announcement. That was on Wednesday that I said that. Not 24 hours later, TheWrap.com broke the news that the deal is virtually done. That's their words. Virtually done. To bring All Elite Wrestling to TNT starting this fall, with the announcement to be made, and maybe plans have changed now that this is leaked, but according to The Wrap, the plan had been to wait until about an hour before the Warner Media upfronts this Wednesday at Madison Square Garden to make the announcement about All Elite Wrestling coming to the Warner network of families. They specifically in the article singled out TNT. So I'm good. That's why I say TNT and not just the Warner networks or Turner networks. This would be, though, if it ends up on TNT, this would be the first time that wrestling would be back on the network since the last Nitro aired in March of 2001. That is when they severed all ties with professional wrestling. They did not want professional wrestling. That's what killed the deal for Eric Bischoff and his investor, Fusion Media, to buy WCW and relaunch it. They were going to have that Big Bang pay-per-view in May of that year. They already had a plan. Once they lost their TV, that was it. The deal was dead, and that allowed Vince McMahon to swoop in and pick the bones for a lot less than the, I think, $75 million that was rumored that they were buying WCW for, Bischoff and the investor. To go from $75 million to about $2.5 million, that's a hell of a drop. That's a company that just wants to unload this thing no matter what. I'm surprised they didn't give it away. But that's how long it's been since wrestling has been on the Turner Networks and specifically on TNT. 2001. And at a time when WWE programming is as bland and uninspired as it has ever been, this news could not come at a better time. So if you are on the bandwagon of bashing All Elite Wrestling, you're not a fan, it's so overhyped, I hope that, you know, people get smacked in the face by reality and it doesn't do as well. I mean, there are people saying things like that. And then there are people saying, look, I don't wish, you know, for AEW to fail, but it is overhyped and people do need to dial back their expectations. And I think that's a fair criticism. But to the idiots out there who are practically celebrating and hoping that this thing falls flat on its face, and I've said this before, you are not a real wrestling fan. You are a fraud. You are a troll. And that's why nobody takes people like you seriously. Because if you were a wrestling fan, you would want this to succeed. Because who knows what other doors it could open up for other promotions. That's why the one really bad thing about WWE's ratings crashing and burning the way they have the last few weeks, although on the one hand, you know, I kind of enjoy it in that you would hope that it lights a fire under their ass. The bad thing about it, though, is that it does not paint a very good picture for wrestling right now to television executives. If they see that WWE, the biggest company in the world, is seeing record low numbers. You know, that can't inspire confidence among all these other network executives. And maybe they're in negotiations with All Elite Wrestling or Ring of Honor or other promotions, MLW, whoever, and they may think twice about doing business with these people. They may think twice about working out a deal or giving them a good time slot. You know, I mean, as WWE goes, so goes everybody else. I think that that is still in a lot of ways very true. So, you know, this is if this becomes official this week, and by the time you listen to this, you may have your answer. I think we'll have our answer by Wednesday. But if and when this becomes official, this is a game-changing announcement. Without knowing how it's going to do, without knowing how that first show in October is going, or September, whenever it debuts, is going to do, without knowing that, this is a potential game-changer. You know, I don't use language like that a lot. That's press release speak, right? When a new promotion gets a new show or so, it's game-changing, it's revolutionary. But, you know, this is language that really could apply here in this situation. And if you're a wrestling fan, you should be excited. You should be happy about this. You'll have another option on whatever night it may air. Tuesday night, Wednesday night, whatever it ends up being. I know, you know, the Tuesday night Dynamite copyright or trademark, whatever they took out many months ago, could be a sign of which night they're going to air. Of course, on TNT, you have the issue where Tuesdays and Thursdays are pretty much owned by the NBA, especially around playoff time. Do you really want to, you know, have a situation where AEW would be preempted? Well, who knows? Maybe they're on TNT, and the times that they're preempted by sports, they get bumped to TBS, which is another strong network in the Turner family. You know, we don't know the structure of the deal, and we won't for at least a few more days, but it's possible. It could be on TNT on a Tuesday night, but, you know, ends up on another strong network on those nights where they would be preempted. Or maybe they just end up on an entirely different night. I certainly would stay away from Monday night. That's one piece of advice. Not that anybody is asking me for advice, but that's one piece of advice I would give. Stay away from Monday night. Nothing good could come from that for anybody. You know, this is not 20 years ago. You're not going to have a show air on Monday night, and all of a sudden it's going to double or triple the size of the wrestling audience like Nitro did. That will not happen. They need to just focus on their own shit, run on a different night, get a strong slot, and don't focus on being a competitor to WWE or sticking it to WWE, poking the bear, prodding the bear. You focus on you. You focus on putting out the best roster and the best show possible. And the chips will fall where they may. You would think that would hopefully be enough to grow the audience. We're going to find out real quick, once this thing launches, just how many wrestling fans there are out there. I don't know that All Elite Wrestling is going to convert too many casuals into diehard hardcore wrestling fans. Maybe they'll bring back some of those lapsed fans, but it's 20 years. 20 years since WCW died. Almost. That's a long time. People have moved on. They've gotten older. They've died. I mean, look, you know there were a lot of older folks watching that WCW program 20 years ago. Some of them aren't around anymore. And it's one thing to be a lapsed fan and say, well, you know, I used to watch the show and I gave up on it a few years ago and now I might give this new one a, you know, like a chance. I might try to get back into it. When almost 20 years goes by, that's a lifetime. So I do think that you need to sort of temper your expectations. I would agree with that. These people who think in some case, oh, well, you know, All Elite Wrestling is going to launch and they're going to get 2 million viewers and they're going to maybe even have more viewers than Raw has and SmackDown has in recent weeks. Hey, you know what? I hope it happens. I hope it happens. I'll be watching. But I find it hard to believe that this new promotion is going to suddenly launch and right out of the gate you're going to have, you know, even a million. 2 million people. Where are these people coming from? It's going to take time to build that audience up. And I think if you set your expectations lower, I think that's where it should be. But I think if people have expectations that this thing out of the gate is going to have 2-3 million viewers, you're going to be sorely mistaken. You're going to be very disappointed. It takes time to build interest in your product and show people, hey, this is who we are and this is what we're all about. You put together a good show, the viewers will come. You would hope. You know, look, there have been some good TV shows on you know, network television that were really good and never could build an audience, and they got canceled after their first or second season. You know, Lucha Underground. I was a huge fan of Lucha Underground. I watched all 4 seasons. But they were not on a strong network. So, you know, very limited ratings information would even leak out about that show. I think the highest number I ever saw reported for a Lucha Underground episode was, I mean, maybe in the 200,000 range. But, you know, especially towards the end, you would hear, oh, the show did 90,000, 100,000, 80,000. El Rey is not TNT. But, you know, being on TNT, it's like when Impact was on Spike. Spike, which is now Paramount Network, was a strong channel, not as strong as TNT. But look, Raw aired there for about 5 years. And Impact really only hit the 2 million mark for one show. And that was a 3-hour live special they loaded up with big names. They never hit those numbers again. And that was a network that was available in tens upon tens of millions of homes. You've got to put together a compelling product. You've got to put together a good show. It's one of the reasons why WWE is bleeding viewers, because they've lost their way. They don't know how to do that anymore. So all AEW has to do is do the opposite of what WWE is doing and actually give people a product that's compelling that they want to watch. And if you mix in some really good wrestling in there, that's even better. But it can't just be about the wrestling. It has to be a fun show. And I'm sorry to say, all the purists out there who will say, well, all they have to do is put together these great matches, these 4- and 5-star matches. 5-star matches are not going to get you ratings every week. Not the numbers that they're looking for. That really is not what this is about. I hate to burst your bubble. But if that's their plan, to just put out 5-star matches, this thing is not going to work. They need to have a battle plan for a compelling television show here. Wrestling is only one part of it. You know, when wrestling was doing hot all those years ago in the late 90s, it wasn't just about great wrestling matches every week. We get more great wrestling matches on TV now than we did 20 years ago, so why were the numbers so high back then? Why were they so much higher? Why was there so much more interest in wrestling back at a time when the emphasis every week wasn't on the quality of the in-ring matches? Not every week. You had characters, you had stories, personalities that you could buy into and that you kind of lived through vicariously or were fun to follow. That's the most important thing. And if they happen to be able to wrestle really well, well, hey, all the better. They have to find the recipe that works for them. And as far as TNT compared to USA, TNT is a big deal. If you don't live in this country and have no concept of this, TNT is a big cable network, one of the biggest. And I believe it's only ranked right now, maybe a couple of spots in the overall cable rankings behind USA Network, which is the home of WWE. So this is a big deal. If this deal goes through. But that's what I think they need to do to succeed here, or at least have the best chance to succeed. Maybe they won't. But if you're a wrestling fan, for the sake of wrestling, for the future of wrestling, you should be hoping that they find that recipe for success. Anybody rooting against AEW is rooting against wrestling, and you are not a fan. You are a fraud. And AEW continues to make roster moves. They've brought Jerry Lynn in as a coach, producer, veteran, not to wrestle, but to contribute. And Jerry Lynn is a very well-respected, very bright person. I think a good pickup for them. And also, the tag team, I guess they're going to be teaming up, of Angelico and Jack Evans from, Lucha Underground. If you were a Lucha Underground fan like I was, you remember them from that show. Obviously, they've wrestled all over the place. Angelico has been spending most of his time wrestling over in Europe. I haven't heard too much about him recently until this video popped up this week. This vignette of him talking about the next step in his career. And he gets a phone call and it's from his buddy Jack Evans. And then they show Angelico signing his All Elite Wrestling contract. And so Angelico is coming in. Jack Evans is coming in. And I will always remember Angelico for the insane balcony dive, which is still one of the biggest bumps I've ever seen. One of the greatest, spots, bumps, stunts, call it whatever you want. It will always be seared into my brain, the image of him flying off that balcony onto Cortez Castro and his partner and saving Ivelisse at the last second. He was all the way up on the balcony and, you know, they were building this story. They were about to attack Ivelisse. And nobody else was around. Son of Havoc was on the outside of the ring. And Helico, he's just too far up. There's no way he can get back down in time. And then Helico, of course, in his mind is like, hold my beer. And he comes flying from the roof of the building. It was this insane stunt. Everybody was going crazy. Vampiro threw his headset down and basically ran a lap around the ring. He was so excited. It's crazy. That's what I will always remember Angelico for. I don't know that he'll ever be able to top that. But he's a talented guy, and I think he and Evans are, again, a great pickup for All Elite Wrestling. It reminded me of that trio from Lucha Underground that I really liked. Of Angelico, Son of Havoc, and Ivelisse. I was a big fan of that trio. And Ivelisse just had a tryout at the WWE Performance Center. So if they're too stupid to snatch her up, maybe she can land in All Elite Wrestling. Maybe we can get a reunion of that trio. Or maybe just have her with Evans and Angelico. But this gives the AEW Tag Team Division a bit of a boost. They have a Tag Team Division now that includes Angelico and Jack Evans, the Young Bucks, Pentagon and Phoenix, the Lucha Bros, SoCal Uncensored. I believe they have the Best Friends, right? Chucky T and Trent Beretta. They have them under contract as well. And Private Party, which is a House of Glory team that they recently signed. I mean, I remember hearing about this months ago, but they made the announcement just recently that they have signed with AEW. And I've seen some of their matches live. They're very talented, very young, but still very talented. And it's a great pickup for AEW. So their tag team division, when you really look at the roster they've put together so far, is shaping up very nicely. Monday Night Raw was live from Cincinnati, Ohio this past week. We had more than double the response that we've had recently. The number of votes that we've had in these Twitter polls has sort of sagged as interest in the show has waned every Monday night. But boy, I noticed the numbers spike when people are either really, really excited or really, really pissed off. I'll give you one guess as to what this week was. We had 4,260 votes in the poll this week. And of those 4,200 votes, and that's a good sample size, okay? We're not talking 2,000 or 2,500 or even 3,000. Over 4,000 votes. That's like pay-per-view numbers. 8% thumbs up. 92% thumbs down. That's 92% thumbs straight up your ass in the poll this week. I mean, do I even have to say anything else? Imagine if WWE was a sports team. And they had a record of 8-92. You know what would happen to the manager or the coach of a team that went 8-92 on the season? Do you know what would happen? Well, I mean, if James Dolan owned the team, he'd probably give the guy a fucking raise. But if it were anyone else, any other owner, that person would be fired. But that's not how it works here in WWE. The players change all the time, but the coach stays year after year, failure after failure, and nothing ever really changes. The scenery might change. Like I said, the players change all the time. The wallpaper comes down. They put new wallpaper. Things change. But that never does. And sometimes that's all it takes. A new coach with a new vision. Or a new philosophy. On who they draft to be on their team. How they use them. How they use those players. Not here in WWE. You know, it was 20 years ago this week that Raw drew the highest rating in the history of the show, the highest Nielsen number in the history of the show. They went unopposed that night. I remember it well. I still have the newspaper clipping. They got such high numbers that week on TV that in the TV column of the New York Daily News, I clipped the little article out that they had the headline with the rating in it. That's how big of a number and big of a deal that was that week back in May of 1999. But they went unopposed that night. Nitro was preempted due to the NBA playoffs. Monday Night Raw did an 8.1 rating, which equated to 9.2 million viewers. I think people sometimes get confused with the Nielsen numbers. They hear like 8.1 or 2.2, and they think, well, that means 2.2 million or 8.1 million. Not exactly. That does not equate to the number of viewers in the millions. So an 8.1 on that particular week equated to a 9.2 million viewer figure. Over 10 million viewers saw the main event, the overrun of Stone Cold, The Rock, and Vince McMahon against The Undertaker, Triple H, and Shane McMahon. Now, some of that big audience they got that night obviously was a portion of the Nitro audience they were able to pull in. They pulled in a lot more of the Nitro audience than they normally would have when Nitro was preempted. They got a lot of people to put their show on instead, which is pretty impressive. 9 million, 10 million. Look at these numbers. And it just goes to show there were a lot of wrestling fans back then. That's kind of the moral of the story. WWE, WCW, ECW. The point is, there were a lot more wrestling fans back then. 10 million viewers. This past Monday, they were up, although only slightly. You know what they were up to? 2.2 million viewers. What a difference 20 years can make. 20 years and new technology like DVR and YouTube. Yes, that is true. And they tried a new experiment on Monday night. They stopped uploading clips of the show in real time. So normally as the show is going on and it's live in progress, they are uploading clips to their YouTube channel before the show is even over. They did not do that on Monday night. And it did not seem to make a huge difference in the overall numbers this week, but it's still early. If they continue to do that, if this is their new experiment, you got to give it a few weeks. And in a few weeks, we should have a better picture of just how much the YouTube stuff hurts the ratings. Because I hear that from people. When I talk about the rating stuff, I hear from people, oh, Solomonster, you're not considering YouTube. I go online and I look at, so do I. I do the same thing sometimes. If I miss a segment or whatever, I'll catch it on the YouTube channel. I understand this is going on. I'm not stupid. But people will sometimes use that as an excuse. Well, that explains away a lot of the lost viewers. I'm sure that really, you know, whether it's half or whatever, a lot of those lost viewers are probably coming from people who just go on YouTube and watch the clips. You know what? If they keep this experiment up a few more weeks, you may have your answer. We're going to find out. We're going to find out just how much it hurts. Didn't seem to hurt too much this week. I would hardly consider that a great number. So instead of being the lowest of all time, it was what, second lowest? Even taking those things into account, though, I mentioned DVR and YouTube. Even taking those things into account, here's my question. Where did those 8 million people go? That's a lot of people to just sort of disappear and vanish out of thin air. Where did they go? Where did those 8 million people go? This show is an abomination. There's no beating around the bush anymore. I watched that show on Monday night. This show is an abomination. Worse than that Reign of Terror period on Raw with Triple H that I hated all those years ago. But at least back then, we had SmackDown as the true A show, which it absolutely was in 2002 into 2003. SmackDown was the A show. We had SmackDown to even things out. Now, we don't even have that. Some weeks we do. SmackDown was better than Raw this week. That's not saying much. But it was better than Raw. But even that isn't a guarantee anymore. Truer words have never been spoken than what Daniel Bryan said about Monday Night Raw when he said, "There is nothing fun about Monday Night Raw." You heard the clip at the top of the show. There is nothing fun about Monday Night Raw. They actually had Daniel Bryan scripted to say that in the ring on Monday night. Talk about a lack of self-awareness. That was a shoot. That may not have been the way it was intended, but that was a shoot. I want the fun back. I'm not giving up. I'm not walking away like those 8 million people did. Not yet. I'm getting close. But not yet. I want the fun back. I want the F back. Remember that ad campaign when they changed over from WWF to WWE? Get the F out. I want to start a new campaign to get the F back in. Per the Observer, Vince McMahon, he saw the record low numbers last week and he reacted. And he reacted by canceling the SmackDown house show in Kentucky that was scheduled for that Monday night because he wanted all hands on deck with the SmackDown crew at Raw. Don't ever let anyone tell you ever again that ratings don't matter. They canceled an entire show on Monday because apparently they still do matter. He wanted the SmackDown crew at Raw because of his newest brainchild, the wild card rule. A rule that even he himself, in the opening segment on Raw, seemed to be confused by. The look that AJ Styles had on his face as Vince McMahon was trying to explain this new concept was priceless. He looked like he was having TNA war flashbacks. That's what he looked like. And it is sadder and sadder every time I see Vince McMahon out there on TV, tripping over his own words, mumbling things into the microphone. It was a parade of promos for the first half hour of this show. Roman Reigns came out and Daniel Bryan came out and Kofi Kingston and Drew McIntyre and AJ Styles and Vince McMahon announcing the wild card rule, where each week, three superstars from Raw will be allowed to appear on SmackDown and three SmackDown stars will be allowed to appear on Raw. Before the show is over, he had already changed the rule to four. Any four stars from either brand can appear on the other show any given week. Until next week, when it changes again. Here's an idea. I have a crazy idea here. You want to hear it? Of course you do. That's where you're listening. Here's an idea. If you don't love her, dump her. I gave that advice once to a friend. If you don't love her, dump her. If you're not ready to make a commitment, don't drag this out any longer. Just dump her. Drop the entire brand split if you cannot commit yourself to it. The idea that this completely damages the credibility of the superstar shakeup. I saw those comments up and down the line after the show on Monday. This is ridiculous. What was the point of the superstar? Which is true. What was the point of the superstar shakeup? I'll tell you why in a second. Oh, what was the point? It just completely undermines the credibility of the draft, of the shakeup. To say that would imply that it had credibility and was taken seriously in the first place. Newsflash, it didn't, and it wasn't. But it did kill some time on TV for a couple of weeks, so there's your answer. WWE.com tried to explain the changes after the show was over. This is a quick summary of how they described it on the website. The latest wrinkle in the ongoing superstar shakeup emerged Monday night on Raw when Mr. McMahon announced a new wild card rule in which a limited number of superstars from Raw or SmackDown would be invited to cross brand lines for one night only appearances, with unauthorized jumps to be penalized by fines or even potential firing. Superstars crossing between Raw and SmackDown Live has, of course, occurred on more... has occurred on rare occasions since the 2000s. These fucking people got a lot of balls. They have brass balls when they put these summaries together, I must say. Superstars crossing between Raw and SmackDown has been rare since 2016. That's what they wrote. That's what I'm reading here. But the wild card rule, it says, is the first officially sanctioned blurring of the lines between Team Red and Team Blue. And although this isn't to say that we're about to go back to the days of Raw Super Shows or do away with the brand extension, there are some staggering implications to the rule depending on who decides to take advantage of it. Now, how these names are chosen, it says invite only. I don't know what that means. How these names are chosen or how any of this will actually play out and work has not been explained. This is the old Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. They may be able to give us a few big matches out of it, a few championship matches, but it's going to take more than some big matches to really get people invested in these stories and in these personalities, which clearly they are not. Clearly they are not. Something is not working. Bobby Lashley and Baron Corbin against Seth Rollins and AJ Styles is not an example of one of those big matches that I'm talking about, but that's how they followed up the first 30 minutes of this show. With a tag team match, of course. Forcing Rollins and AJ to do the reluctant partners deal, which ended with AJ accidentally nailing Seth Rollins, which led to Corbin picking up the win for his team. And this is another big problem with these shows, because they have so much talent under contract, and because they have so much television time, we have to shove as many people in these matches and in these segments as humanly possible, we end up with tag team matches every week. I mean, this is Teddy Long's dream. I blame him. I blame him for this epidemic. Although I bet if I went back and I sort of looked at things and analyzed things, I'm sure this has been going on long before he came along. But just this explosion in tag team matches on these shows every week, this over-reliance on tag team matches and six-man tags and eight-man tags. You know, a few tag team matches are fine, but every week with this, and the problem is they mean absolutely nothing. They mean nothing. They're time filler. And that's one thing, one of many, that they need to scale back on. Braun Strowman, he came out to shut up Sami Zayn. Sami Zayn came out to cut another promo. Braun couldn't take it anymore. He came out, chased him away, ended up picking him up and putting him in a dumpster in the back of the building. He should have tossed this entire fucking show into that dumpster where it belongs. We had two WrestleMania rematches on this show. Roman Reigns against Drew McIntyre, which was better at least than their WrestleMania match, although that's not saying much because that match was a complete afterthought. Shane McMahon ran in for the DQ, ended up being chased away by The Miz. We had The Revival. The Revival were scheduled to wrestle Gallows and Anderson in a loser wishes they could leave town match. And the winners probably do as well. But it never got started. The Usos walked out to reveal that they had rubbed their version of Icy Hot, which they were calling Usy Hot, all over their gear, the Revival that is, before they put it on. And on cue, Dash and Dawson start shaking and flailing around like they were on fire. By this point, I wanted to set this entire show on fire. They begged the Usos for water, which they poured down their crotch. That only made things worse, and they ran away. Let me remind you that people are actually paid to write this shit. Actual American dollars, coins, dollar bills, they're paid to write shit like this. And I'm going to hear from people, Solomonster. It's not the fault of the writers. Cut them a break. It's Vince McMahon. At what point, let me ask you this, at what point then do they stand up and fight for all of these supposedly great ideas that people seem to think that these writers have. I thought some of them were supposed to filter through. Not all of them, but some of them. At what point do we get to see some of these wonderful ideas that they hire these people to come up with? We could sure use some of them right now. I don't see any. Do you? Where are these great ideas that we're supposed to see? Am I looking in the wrong place here? How much longer are we supposed to wait? When they chase away another 500,000 people? Tell me. I would love to know. Everybody makes excuses. It's not this person's fault. It's not that person's fault. Everybody gives these people a pass. And that's why we end up with shit like this. Stop giving them a pass. Even Carl Anderson's wife couldn't help but tweet about how stupid this segment was. And what a waste of talent it was. Her words, not mine. Fightful.com. They broke the story that lead writer for Monday Night Raw, Ryan Callahan, or one of the lead writers anyway, was fired by WWE the week before. Had nothing to do with the ratings. Had nothing to do with bad TV and the fact that the show sucks. Instead, it was because he was butting heads with another writer, another creative force behind the scenes, Dave Kapoor. He used to play Ranjan Singh years ago, managing the great Kali. He's been with the company for a long time. He butted heads with Callahan, and so they fired Callahan. This on the heels of Road Dogg stepping down as the co-head writer of SmackDown, the heels of R.D. Evans quitting before he could be fired. You can't fire me, I quit, right? At the Hall of Fame. For Bret Hart mentioning Vince McMahon's name in his speech. On the heels of Dave Schilling, who used to write about wrestling for Bleacher Report and 411 Mania and a whole bunch of other websites, big wrestling fan. He announced that he was joining the WWE creative team. This was back in February. He was all excited. I could not be more thrilled to have this opportunity in the industry that I love. That is, until April, when news leaked that Schilling was already gone from the creative team. Cue the Grandpa Simpson gif. Why is all of this happening, huh? Why now? What is going on over there? But it's not just the writers. It's not just a writing issue. The format of the show is so stale, the way they produce their announcers, a lot of the stuff is even beyond the reach of the writers. This show needs a complete overhaul, now more so than at any point in the 26-year history of this show, the show that Raw replaced in 1993 was primetime wrestling. Primetime wrestling went through its own format change, actually multiple format changes. It used to be a studio show. It was hosted by Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan. Not right from the beginning. I think that from the beginning it was Monsoon and Jesse Ventura, but it was a studio show. It was Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan, a lot of their banter back and forth, with a lot of clips from matches from around the country mixed in. That was the format. And skits. And that worked for a long time. Until they changed it to a studio show with a live audience and guests and other skits. Then it had one last format change to a panel-type format with Vince McMahon at the head of the table with Monsoon and Heenan and a bunch of revolving hosts every single week. I assume the ratings were not doing that great, so they were trying different things. You don't undergo three format changes in a 3 or 4 year time span if your show is doing big numbers. You would stick with what works, and clearly what they were doing they felt wasn't working, and so they tried new things. They had the sense and the courage to try new things, try new formats for the show, until Monday Night Raw debuted, the ultimate format change. I wish they had that same courage today. I'm talking in general, not just the show format. Show format, the set, the look and feel of the arena, not pitching to commercial every 5 seconds the way they do every single week. Every segment ends with someone making a mean face. We got to zoom in on the mean face. You hear people from off camera, smile, smile. It's always the same format, the same pattern, every single segment, every single week. Something has to change. We cut right to, after a segment like that, ooh, mean face, rrr, mean face. Okay, so then we cut right to the announcers in the foreground, cracking jokes. We're talking about, oh, all right, switching gears now. Let's suck our own dick and talk about the great charity work that we do. Meanwhile, you see the guys in the background, like, walking off. Like an actor who just played their part, exiting stage left. Promos. We had Seth Rollins and Kofi Kingston deliver backstage promos by themselves, staring right into the camera. That's a small change. I think they should do more of that. But when it all comes right down to it, these are all cosmetic changes. Necessary ones, I think. But all cosmetic all the same. It all boils down to whether or not you are putting out matches and storylines that the audience finds compelling. Or entertaining. Look, I like good comedy as much as anybody. I'm not a total stick in the mud. I don't just want straight wrestling matches for 3 hours. Just like I don't think all Elite Wrestling should be focusing on just great matches. It should never be about just great matches. Usy Hot in front of a dead crowd is not compelling television. 30-minute talking segments is not compelling television. Vince McMahon on camera is no longer compelling television. He's the greatest on-screen character maybe in the history of the show. Greatest heel they've ever had. But not anymore. He is a shell of what he once was. And he stands there and calls himself a genius, like he did on Monday when he came up with the whole wild card concept. He's like, oh, it's brilliant. I'm a genius. And I believe that he really thinks that. What a brilliant idea. I'm a genius. And he waited for applause that never really came. Like a politician at a town hall who makes this great point and then has to stand there and say, please clap. It's embarrassing. And I will say the same thing I said last week when I talked about the Luke Harper stuff. For the sake of his company and the sake of his product, Vince McMahon needs to step aside from the creative end and trust somebody else enough to bring a fresh pair of eyes to this tired television show. Vince McMahon doesn't get certain people. How many times have we heard that? He doesn't get Luke Harper. Who knows how many other people he doesn't get? You know what? I don't get Vince McMahon anymore. We don't get you, Vince. And if we are the authority, like you and your son-in-law said that we are, when do we get to take you off of television? We had the latest Firefly Funhouse segment with Bray Wyatt. This time, Mercy the Buzzard could be seen eating something in his box, his nest. Bray goes over to check and see what it is, and he pulls out the remains, the stuffing, of Ramblin' Rabbit. Mercy the Buzzard murdered Ramblin' Rabbit here on the Firefly Funhouse this week. And I'm sure there's some symbolism in there. Ramblin' Rabbit, whatever he represents. Maybe it's, Bray used to ramble in his promos or whatever it may be. So there's some kind of symbolism here. I don't want to go too deep into this. Philosophical argument here. It was horrifying to see that Ramblin' Rabbit was killed off of this show here. So rest in peace to Ramblin' Rabbit. We then got a shot of all of these young children sitting on the floor in the funhouse, and they looked about as excited to be there as they were probably to be watching Monday Night Raw. They had all of these looks on their faces like they had been drugged. They were half asleep. And Bray did the same thing where he said, I'll light the way for you, my Fireflies, and all you have to do, and he got kind of serious, and he said, is let me in. And that was the episode this week. Still the highlight of Raw. Every Monday is the Firefly Funhouse segment. I hope it never ends. Although, there's clearly going to be a payoff to this, and hopefully it's a good one, but I will miss these segments when they stop airing them. Michael Cole said that for the first time in 3 years, we have a WWE Championship match on Monday Night Raw, which was the main event of Kofi Kingston against Daniel Bryan. This was quite the episode of SmackDown this week on Monday night. Now he says this, the fact that this is the first time in 3 years that we have a WWE title match on Raw, he says this after we watched Kofi Kingston defend the WWE Championship in a title versus title match on Monday Night Raw just last month. I should know because I was there. I was in the building when it happened, so I know it was not a mirage. I know I was not hallucinating. I was not on mushrooms. Or MDA or whatever that stuff is. I know what I saw, and I saw a WWE title defense on Raw last month. They must think that we are really that stupid. That's the level of... You know, we heard recently that they're looking to hire a member of the creative team, somebody that can oversee storyline consistency. I assume that position remains unfilled. And I sure as fuck am not going to put my name in to fill that position. But boy, could they use somebody to try to keep consistency on this show and actually have the announcers talk about stuff that makes sense. I can't put that all on Michael Cole, but boy, was that a stupid thing for him to say. So we had Daniel Bryan and Kofi Kingston, WrestleMania rematch, the second one, on this show. This was one of the few highlights, other than the Firefly Funhouse, of the entire show. The entire 3 hours. They had a very good match, and the best part was that the champion went over clean and strong in the end. There was no controversy, there was no ambiguity, there was no, you know, anything. Kofi hit the Trouble in Paradise kick and he pinned him 1-2-3 right in the middle of the ring. A strong, needed win for Kofi Kingston as he prepares to defend his championship against Kevin Owens at Money in the Bank. It was a good week for the WWE champion. And that's one of the few things I can say about this deplorable show. SmackDown Live from Louisville, Kentucky. We had the two nameless men, Ali and Andrade. They had a match. It was very good for the 5 minutes that it lasted. We had Ali hit a Spanish fly off the top turnbuckle. Fans were really into this. All of a sudden, Randy Orton jumped in and attacked Ali for the DQ. He tried to give a draping DDT on the ropes to Andrade, but Zelina Vega held onto his leg to protect him. Ali went after Orton. He fought him off. In the end, Orton laid both of them out with RKOs. And that's how this ended here. Shane McMahon, he was in the ring with the SmackDown Tag Team titles, which were vacated the week before by the Hardy Boys. Jeff had surgery. He's going to be gone for a while. And so the way the description of SmackDown was written going into the show made you think that Shane was going to crown new champions, as though he was just going to hand the titles over to somebody. And he was poised to do that. He called out Daniel Bryan and Rowan, and he said that he was going to present them with the SmackDown Tag Team titles. And instead, the Usos interrupted with the wild card rule and all. And by the way, everybody's saying that, oh, WWE broke the rule already on this show. You know, they said it's going to be 4 stars going from one show to the other every week. And here they had 5 because you count each Uso as a star. And they had the Usos, they had Sami Zayn, AJ Styles, and The Miz all appeared on SmackDown on Tuesday. Well, they count the Usos as one. I mean, even I know that. You know, that's why they drafted them together on Raw. They count them as one singular act. So, you know what? I'm actually not going to give them shit for that. But the Usos came out and they tried to convince Shane to make a match with them, taking on Bryan and Rowan for the tag team titles, which Shane agreed to. Now, if they're going to do this wild card nonsense, they at least have to set some ground rules, like not being able to challenge for the other brand's title. I mean, what sense does that even make? What the hell is that? The Usos can come to SmackDown and challenge for the tag team titles as Raw stars? Did they spend more than 5 minutes thinking about this? Don't answer that. But what followed turned into a damn good match in those last few minutes. I will say that. Rowan gave Jey Uso the claw slam for the win. Bryan and Rowan are your new SmackDown Tag Team Champions. Miz attacked Shane after all of this before the B-Team came out to gang up on him. Miz fought them off but got pasted with a chair from behind and left for dead by Shane. You know, is this a downgrade for Daniel Bryan to go from being the WWE Champion to being the SmackDown Tag Team Champion? I mean, obviously it's a downgrade in terms of his position on the card, but I don't see anything wrong with it because here's the deal. Kofi Kingston got hot at a time when nobody expected him to get as hot as he did. The fans got behind him, and they had this great story that they were able to put together going into wrestling. And that's what I mean. You know, WWE, they have the ability when they want to, and when somebody does get hot, or somebody does catch on with the crowd, look at Becky Lynch, they've demonstrated, even this year, that they have the ability to deliver a good story. And that Kofi Kingston arc was great. They built him up as this sympathetic babyface who came so close in the Elimination Chamber but fell just short. You know, and they had that great shot of him when the Elimination Chamber was over and New Day came out to sort of comfort him and tell him, you know, look, brother, there'll be another day. He's sitting on the steps of the Elimination Chamber, and they had that great camera shot where right over his head in the background, you could see the WrestleMania sign. And that should have been a sign of where this was headed and what they had planned. And then we got the big payoff at WrestleMania. And I know a lot of people don't buy into Kofi Kingston at that level. And they don't like him as WWE champion. Everyone's got an opinion. It's a very divisive thing. I get that. But put that aside. Put your personal feelings for him aside for a second. It was a great story to tell. And obviously there was history behind him, you know, as an African-American star winning the WWE championship at WrestleMania. That hasn't happened very often, obviously. And so it was a great story. They have the ability when they want to and when they have the tools at their disposal and somebody catches fire to deliver. So they haven't totally forgotten how to tell good stories. They just have to do a better job of it. And unfortunately, they don't have a lot of people who are quote-unquote hot at the moment. Even Kofi Kingston and Becky Lynch, you know, they're hot to an extent, but hot is a relative term. You know, when I say that they caught fire or that they're a hot act, are they a hot act as compared to other hot acts 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago? Not even close. I mean, you can make that argument more with Becky, but not with Kofi. But for now, you know, Kofi is still, he's very popular and the people are behind him and they cheer for him every week. And that's why this week was so important, I think, to give him two big championship, clean championship wins the way they did on TV. He needed some wins like that going into that Money in the Bank match with Kevin Owens. So they have the ability to do this. But why don't they do it more often? That's the question they need to figure out. That's the issue they need to address. But as far as Brian is concerned, to go back to my point, Kofi got hot. It was the right thing to do, to put the title on Kofi and give him a run. He may never have this chance again. When his run is over, that's probably it, as far as him at that level. Let's be honest. Whether he loses the championship to Kevin Owens, whether he loses the championship in Saudi Arabia, or they let him hold it all the way to SummerSlam. When the day comes that Kofi Kingston loses the WWE title, he is unlikely to get that title back for the foreseeable future, if ever again. That's just the reality of the situation. When things die down and the story, you know, calls for him to drop the title, I don't see him getting it back. I don't see him staying at that main event level. He'll drop down a peg or two, kind of to where he was before. He'll be better off for having been the champion and having been at that level and worked with the top guys. But I don't necessarily see him staying at that level where he continues to work with main eventers at the top of the show. So you got to strike while the iron is hot. Take advantage of the situation, give the guy a run, see how far he can go, and when his run is over, his run is over. And you move on to whoever the next hot hand is, or you get the belt on a heel. And Bryan, I thought, was a great heel. Put it on a great heel and hope that you can build up another big baby face. And they can sort of take the baton and then you can give them a shot and see how far they can go with it. But this is Kofi's time. Bryan is not getting the belt back anytime soon. So to put a different championship on him, even though the tag team belts arguably don't mean much, you know what? It's not a bad position for him to be in. It gives him a role on the television show every week that I think he can make work and can be entertaining in the role. And it's something, you know, it's a safe spot for him on the show for now, even if it's just temporary, and maybe he'll get the championship back at some point. I don't see it as some kind of insult to Daniel Bryan. It's not his time right now. It's Kofi's time. So what are you going to do with him? Just put him in random meaningless matches every week? You just take him off television altogether? Let him have a run as a tag team champion. I could think of worse positions on the show for him to be in. Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville beat Ember Moon and Carmella in a 2-minute match. That comes after the one women's match on Raw this week did not even break 40 seconds. The ring time for the ladies has been drastically reduced ever since WrestleMania. We have reverted back to the Diva stopwatch period these last few weeks. Which is funny when I read stories about Becky Lynch's WrestleMania opponent. I know Meltzer had something in The Observer about this and how her opponent next year has already been penciled in. Nobody knows who it is, but it's already been penciled in. It's not Charlotte. And at this moment, it's not scheduled to be Ronda Rousey. So, you know, ooh, who's it going to be? Is it going to be Sasha Banks if she comes back? You know, can they wait that long? Should they wait that long if Sasha does come back and build the match for WrestleMania next year? I don't know that they can afford, frankly, to wait that long. But whoever this person is, supposedly, who's penciled in, it's almost like, you know, they got to start thinking about Becky's opponent a year in advance because she's going to be in the main event again, or she's going to be in a really, really top match again at WrestleMania. But the idea that the plan, let's say, right now would be for her to be in the main event, and I'm not saying it is, but let's say that's the thought process here, it's comical to me. There's absolutely no way. Something would have to change in these next 11 months to convince me that Becky Lynch should be back in the WrestleMania main event next year. Because I don't see an opponent for her that would be compelling enough for me to look at that as a WrestleMania main event. I mean, I did with her and Ronda, but there's been nothing since then. She's got two different feuds going right now, and they both feel cold. Now, maybe that'll change. They're going to have a dual contract signing on TV, I think, on Monday night, with Becky in the ring with both Lacey and Charlotte, so maybe they have a great contract signing, and they can really get people interested in this match, but I don't know. To me, the whole thing feels cold right now. But this idea that they're already thinking about a main event level match at WrestleMania next year, you know, I wouldn't waste too much time and energy on that if this is what you're going to be doing with her. They better have something really good up their sleeve because, you know, again, strike when the iron is hot. This was the year to do it, but I don't know that that's going to carry over into next year. They're going to have somebody worthwhile who can really, you know, spar back and forth with Becky and create something special the way that she had with Ronda. And I just don't know who that could be. I don't look at the roster right now and really see who that person could be. But I guess we'll find out. And I'm sure whoever it is, it's going to change a gazillion times anyway between now and next year. So it kind of doesn't matter. But I did laugh when I read that. But the women's stuff, you know, they have cooled this division down significantly. And a lot of their matches now have been reduced to 2 minutes or less on TV every single week. I mean, you want to talk about a great women's match. I know I'm about 2 weeks late to the party on this, but better late than never. I got around to watching the Tessa Blanchard-Gail Kim match from the Impact Wrestling Rebellion show. And that was better than anything the women did at WrestleMania or have done since in WWE. What a great match that was. Gail Kim, all but out of wrestling now, I think, for years, comes back and puts on the performance of her career. And Tessa, I mean, look, Tessa's going to be a star, a bigger star than she is now, wherever she lands, whether it's WWE or not. And if she does eventually land in WWE, and if she has, you know, aspirations of ending up in WWE, as I'm sure, you know, a lot of people do, if that's where she ends up, there's the natural, you know, sort of horsewomen daughter match, Rick's daughter against Tully's daughter. And I actually think Charlotte and Tessa could be a WrestleMania main event worthy match one day. I'm not saying next year necessarily, but I don't know. I look at that and they're both very good. And I think Charlotte and Tessa could very well be a WrestleMania main event caliber match. But if this is what WWE is going to do with its women, if the last few weeks have been any indication, then you know what? Tessa's probably better staying away for a while. Then we had a backstage segment. What a segment this was. Matt Hardy and R-Truth were in the back with, I was going to say Dasha, but Dasha Bod has been taken offline. But they were backstage with one of the interviewers. And they were talking about Lars Sullivan, who of course has been wreaking havoc on the roster recently, Raw and SmackDown. He's beaten up R-Truth. He's beaten up the Hardy Boys. And so Matt is talking about this, and R-Truth shows up, and all of a sudden, the announcer runs off. She runs away. And Matt is looking, and R-Truth is looking at her as she runs off, and the camera sort of pans out, and we see Lars Sullivan, That's why she ran away. Lars Sullivan is standing, I can't even say behind them. He's practically standing right next to them. Somehow, they don't see this guy. A lifetime, 10 seconds goes by. Matt Hardy then turns, and not heel, but like he turns, and he sees Lars Sullivan standing there. And inexplicably, he shouts, "It's him!" And he immediately goes into a fighting stance. This is the most generic Mortal Kombat fighting stance that I've ever seen. And he's like standing there like the game glitched out and froze. He's standing there in this fighting stance. R-Truth is a little slow, I guess. And he still doesn't see Lars. He kind of turns a little bit, has to pretend that he still doesn't see him. Then he does the full turn. And he sees Lars. And another 2 seconds go by. And then finally Lars attacks R-Truth. Matt goes after Lars and gets thrown into a bathroom, I think, for his troubles. And Lars ends up picking up R-Truth and powerbombing him through a table that is conveniently placed right next to them. I don't know if this was designed to be as campy and cheesy and awful as it looked, but as awful as it looked, it was one of those "it's so bad it's good" segments. And this is going to be just, I'm sure there's already been an explosion of memes. I haven't seen them yet, but how could it not? I don't know. I don't know what they were thinking here. I don't know if this was just, you know, their way of intentionally trying to have a bad segment, or if this was just the plan and they really thought that this was going to come off in a different way. But I don't know. It's him. And then going into the George Mizanin fighting stance is not exactly my idea of Matt Hardy coming across as cool in this instance. But boy, that did make me laugh. And I guess at the end of the day, that's all that matters, right? As long as you're entertained in some way. This segment entertained me, and that's all that matters. Kofi Kingston, AJ Styles, and Sami Zayn. Triple threat match for the WWE Championship. The second WWE title defense on TV this week, back-to-back nights. AJ went for the phenomenal forearm. Kofi cut him off, hit the Trouble in Paradise. AJ fell to the floor. He had been on the apron. Kevin Owens came out at this point. He jumped Xavier Woods from behind. And this distracted Kofi long enough for Sami Zayn to hit a Blue Thunderbomb for a very close near fall. Zayn hit a second Blue Thunderbomb, again, near fall. He hit a third Blue Thunderbomb, and I'm having flashbacks now to Brock Lesnar hitting a third F5 on The Undertaker at WrestleMania. And for a fleeting moment there, I thought that they were going to put the championship on Sami Zayn. But Kofi kicked out for the third time. And when Zayn set him up in the corner for the Huluva kick and came in, Kofi came out with a Trouble in Paradise kick and he pinned Sammy for the win. So one Trouble in Paradise kick apparently is far more damaging than three Blue Thunder bombs. But I don't know that I've ever seen Kofi, or Sammy rather, use the Blue Thunder bomb and actually win with it as a finish. Maybe once he did on TV, but typically it's a setup move. Now, had he hit his Huluva kick three times and Kofi kicked out all three times, that might have bothered me. I guess it does bother me on some level, because I'm a big fan of the Blue Thunder Bomb. Just visually, I think it looks fucking awesome. And I'd love to see Sammy start winning some matches with it, but that becomes hard when, you know, you've got somebody kick out of three of them in a row. But it was a strong win for Kofi. Another big title defense. A win for Kofi Kingston. He'll be a guest on the Kevin Owens show this Tuesday. We also have the four SmackDown entrants in the Men's Money in the Bank match. Randy Orton, Finn Balor, Mustafa Ali, and Andrade Cien Almas will be in a fatal four-way match. And Kairi Sane and Asuka take on Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville. So that is what is on tap for SmackDown this Tuesday. They need to right the ship. They need to right this ship, and they have to do it fast, because there's a lot of people who want to watch these shows and want to enjoy them. And as I said earlier, bring the F back. Bring the fun back. I mean, there are people who just like shitting on things for the sake of shitting on it. That is true. There are people like that out there. But I think there's far more people who want to put their TV on Monday and Tuesdays and actually not feel like they've wasted their life. You have the talent. You have the tools. They got to right the ship. Make something happen. You're supposed to be the biggest company in the world. You're supposed to be the biggest and the best, right? That's what you're supposed to be. WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment, the biggest and the best in the world. Prove it.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
NXT this week was highlighted by one hell of a main event between Matt Riddle and Adam Cole. But first, Mia Yim and Bianca Belair, who graduated college this weekend. So congrats to her. Now she faces her greatest opponent to date, crippling student loan debt. Belair was talking smack the entire match. Mia had to rally her way back. She got Bianca in a tarantula in the ropes, and then hit a sunset flip into the ring. Belair tried to use the ropes for leverage, but the referee saw it. Yim got a roll up for a two count, but when Bianca reversed it, she used her long braid to wrap it around the ring rope. The referee did not see it, and she scored the win. You know, if I wrestled her, I'd bring one of those Brutus Beefcake garden shears to the ring with me and cut that damn thing off. Riddick Moss is back a year after he tore his Achilles tendon. He's actually been back in action since November, but this was the first time for him back on TV. He's got this new gimmick called the Riddick Regiment, which Mauro Ranallo explained on commentary. And congrats to him, by the way. Mauro just signed a new deal to stay on as the lead announcer for NXT. Mauro explained that he came back way quicker than doctors said he would, and he did so following his own regimen. The Riddick Regimen. I just hope he can pass his wellness tests with this Riddick Regimen. He came to the ring with a water bottle and some other piece of equipment he was using to massage his body at different points during the match. I'm sure somebody who is more fitness-oriented than I am will clue me in as to what that thing was. My fitness regimen is 65 minutes on the elliptical, lift some free weights, hit the incline ab bench, and go home. I need somebody to put a program together for me. He wrestled Raul Mendoza, who usually is on his back looking up at the lights, but not this week. He kicked out of a gorilla press drop into a power slam, which is an old Goldberg move. I thought that was the end. He kicked out of that, and then he won with a twisting springboard splash off the ropes. They made a big deal about this. I mean, look, this wasn't 1-2-3 kid pinning Razor Ramon or anything like that, but this was still something of an upset. We had Matt Riddle and Adam Cole in the main event. This was the match that I had proposed being the final of a tournament to crown a new NXT champion when Tommaso Ciampa had to forfeit the title going into that last takeover show before they ultimately announced Adam Cole against Johnny Gargano, which turned out to, you know, only be the best match in NXT history. So I'm hardly complaining. I'm just saying that was the match I originally pitched, was this one here. Ton of action. Cole hit the last shot. Riddle kicked out, only the second person ever to do so after Johnny Gargano. Riddle then came back with a flurry, hit a GTS, hit a powerbomb, knee strike. That sent Cole out to the floor, where Roderick Strong ran down to help Cole back up to his feet. Riddle caught Roddy with a penalty kick. Cole is now back in the ring. Riddle did a flip. He did a flip back over the top rope into the ring onto his feet. And as soon as he landed on his 2 feet, Cole caught him with this awesome super kick that Riddle just sold like death. Referee counts to 2. Riddle reverses, though, into the Bromission for the win. A great match. Matt Riddle's biggest win to date in NXT. With the news that Donovan Dijak just underwent knee surgery for a meniscus tear. Looks like they were building to a North American title match, it looked like, for the next takeover show with him and Velveteen Dream. And now that Dijak is going to be out for a while, you know, if he's not going to be, assuming he's not going to be healthy enough for June 1st, I would not mind a Matt Riddle-Velveteen Dream rematch from their last match at TakeOver. I don't think that's the plan, but I certainly wouldn't mind getting a rematch. The rest of the Undisputed came out to the ring, Undisputed Era did, to try to mediate the tension between Cole and Roddy. Kyle O'Reilly was trying to calm down Adam Cole. Bobby Fish was trying to calm down Roderick Strong. Cole was telling Kyle as they were walking out, look, I won that 5-way match on my own. I didn't need his help, but every other time he comes out here, I get screwed. So this is obviously going to be building to an Adam Cole Roderick Strong match, and I've said this before, my hope is that they can do that But in the end, I hope that they keep this group together. I really do. I think they're better off together than apart right now. And if there is possibly going to be a call-up at some point this year, I'd like to see them all come up together. Because I think they I mean, you could say the same thing about Sanity, which of course went the way of the dinosaur. Now they're extinct. But I would like to think that when that time comes, they see more in the Undisputed Era than they ever did in Sanity. I think they're better off being together than apart. But clearly this is heading for some kind of a match, at least between Cole and with Roddy. The Viceland documentary on the mysterious death of Gino Hernandez aired this week. I watched this a few weeks ago and really enjoyed it. Gino was a huge star in world-class championship wrestling in the early and mid-80s and was only 28 years old when he died in 1986. And he is one of the great what-if stories in wrestling. What if he did not die so young? You know, would he have gone on to work for Vince McMahon? Would he have gone on to work for WCW? Could he have been a world champion? We'll never know. But when Jose Lothario died, I mentioned the fact that he was Gino's trainer. The same man who trained Shawn Michaels also trained Gino Hernandez. And back then, you had men like Randy Savage and Roddy Piper, who were not physically the biggest guys on the roster, but they could talk, and they had charisma, and so did Gino. So even in the land of the monsters back then, I think he would have had a good shot at success in WWE. And for sure, I think he would have had success in the NWA. I mean, I've heard people say that they could have seen Gino as a horseman. Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially given some of the people who ended up becoming horsemen. I think you could have done a lot better with Gino Hernandez as a member of the Four Horsemen. All due respect to Paul Roma, or even Lex Luger. So yeah, I absolutely, you know, could see that. But he was his own worst enemy. He had a bad drug habit. He was his own worst enemy. It's kind of like the Kerry Von Erich situation. You know, Kerry Von Erich was a very talented guy, and he was super popular, and the women were into him, and he, you know, the sky could have been the limit for Kerry Von Erich. But he just wasn't all there. And he had major drug issues, and it's what led to his downfall. Drugs, man. Telling you, in the 1980s, drugs, cocaine. That was the issue for a lot of people back then. Which leads to the question of, what did he die of? Because a lot of people, a lot of wrestlers, even some of his own family members for years believed that Gino was murdered. And I believe Michael Hayes might have said that before, Jake Roberts and people like that. And I think even after you watch this special, whichever side of the fence that you find yourself on, this probably did not do much to change your mind. So if you already had an opinion about this going in, I mean, some minds may have changed. You know, people who bought into certain conspiracy theories maybe now see that maybe it wasn't. But I don't know that it's going to strongly change anyone's opinion if they had a strong one, you know, before they watched this. But they interviewed a whole bunch of people. David Manning, who was also all over the World Class special on the Von Erichs, because he was a referee and a booker for World Class for a number of years. David Manning is featured in this. Bruce Pritchard, who got his start working in that Houston territory and for Paul Mosh back in the day. So he's interviewed for this as well. Jake Roberts, who worked with Gino and partied with Gino by his own admission. Jeannie Clark, who is the ex-wife of Chris Adams, the late Chris Adams, and the ex-wife of Stone Cold Steve Austin. She was the one who, as the story is told, you know, Austin was really bummed about what was going on with, you know, his push in WWE when he first came in and the whole ringmaster gimmick. And she had made tea and said, don't let your tea become stone cold. I mean, you've heard that story before. So she's interviewed in this as well because she was married to Chris at the time. Chris was tag team partners and good friends with Gino. And in fact, I think she had maybe moved into a house next to Gino, was like a neighbor of his. So it made sense that they would get some comments from her. Since Chris is not alive anymore, they couldn't interview him for this. And they also interviewed, you know, Gino's ex-wife, his daughter, and Gino's mother, Patrice, who is the real star of this special. Gino, the basic story here is that as talented as he was, and he was, on a personal level, behind the scenes, off camera, Gino ran with the wrong crowd Everybody, almost to a T, said the same thing. He hung with the wrong crowd. His ex-wife left him in part because she did not feel safe, given the kind of people that he was associating himself with. His mother said that the last time she saw him, he seemed very nervous, like he felt something might happen to him, he might be in some kind of danger. He was afraid of someone or something. It was Super Bowl Sunday in 86. That was the last time she saw him alive. He thought that people were following him. He told this wild story about being in his car and looking in the rearview mirror, and he saw somebody sitting in the back seat, kind of pop up, and they were sitting in the back seat of his car. And he didn't know if they were there to kill him or what they were there for. And was there actually somebody in the back seat of his car trying to get him? I don't know. I mean, who knows, right? Who could say for sure? But he told people that that's what happened, and he sure seemed to think so. You know, David Manning said that Geno missed a show one night in Oklahoma. He didn't think anything of it, but then he missed a show in Houston. And that is when he knew that something was up. His business manager was looking for him. His business manager called his mother and said, look, you know, we haven't heard from him in a few days. Have you heard from Geno? She said, no, but, you know, it's my birthday and he'll call. So I'm sure, you know, if you don't hear from him first, I will. And of course, Geno never called. So what Manning ended up doing, David Manning sent one of the other world-class referees over to Geno's house. And when he jumped over the wall in the back and he peeked through the window, he saw Geno's body. I mean, he didn't know it was Geno, but he saw a body on the floor. And the cops estimate that he was there for a good 4 to 5 days before he was found. His body was decomposed enough that initially they couldn't determine a cause of death. It took some time. There was a gun on the floor, although he was not shot. Didn't look like the gun was fired. But he had asked David Manning about getting a gun just before all of this happened because he was so damn paranoid. So there being a gun in the home, he wasn't sure where he got the gun from because he had asked Manning, do you have a gun? And Manning at the time was like, look, I don't have a gun. I can't help you. Well, Geno got a gun somehow. Probably wasn't too tough for him to do, given this supposed bad crowd that he was hanging out with. So there was a gun that was found on the floor. They found no sign of drugs in his condo. His mother says, and this is where things really get interesting and kind of creepy. His mother says that shortly after Geno died, she's still in mourning at home. He's not even buried yet. And this man, who identifies himself as a friend of her son, comes to her house one day. And in identifying that he's a friend of her son, she lets him in. And this person, this man, tells her not to worry about the funeral expenses. He's going to pay for Geno's funeral. He's going to pay for all the arrangements. And he says, your son owed me a lot of money, but don't worry about the funeral. I'm going to pay for it. And she said she was scared to death. Just by the way he said it, his tone. Oh, you know, your son owed me a lot of money, but don't worry about it. I'm going to pay for his funeral anyway. She said that it just scared the bejeebus out of her. And it's the same man who gave the eulogy, or one of the eulogies, at Geno's funeral. He showed up. He did this whole speech. He was regaling people with stories about them hanging out together and having fun. And nobody knew who this guy was. Bruce Pritchard and all of the wrestling folks said that they had no idea who this person was. It was surreal. Or who any of the other well-dressed, rich-looking people who showed up to this funeral were. Nobody knew. They all just figured they were drug dealers because they knew what Geno was into. And they saw how well-dressed they were and how they were carrying themselves. And they, you know, I think Pritchard was the one who said he just assumed that they were drug dealers. And they took care of everything. A platinum casket. They're drinking champagne. They're toasting over the casket. They're smashing their champagne glasses over the lid of the casket. You know, there were fans who thought that Chris Adams had murdered him. I mean, this is like you hear the stories of the people who think Kevin Sullivan murdered the Benoit family. You know, he had heat with Benoit and Benoit stole his wife, Nancy, and it was obviously Kevin Sullivan who had something to do with it. And I feel like half the people who say that are trolling and the other half are actually serious and need to be committed to a mental institution. So you have people like that, and here you had people who thought that Chris Adams murdered him because the two of them were in a bitter feud on television at the time. And Gino had blinded him in an angle on TV, and Chris vowed that he was going to kill him. I mean, literally, he was, you know, on television being carried off by security or police or whoever saying, I'm going to kill him, I'm going to kill him. And back then, especially down there in that territory at that time, wrestling was real. It's like you hear stories about, like in the South, college football. It's everything, right? It's taken very seriously and it's a really big deal. And at the time, wrestling, especially in that world-class territory, I feel like maybe that was kind of on the same level with a lot of these people. Like, that's how seriously that people took it and how wildly popular it was. And so people remember that and they say, well, Chris Adams obviously had it out for this guy. He must have had him killed or killed him or he did something. We should interview him, arrest him. It's his fault. He did it. There are people who believed it. Wrestling was real to a lot of these people back then. It's like when Eddie Gilbert hit Jerry Lawler with his car in the parking lot in Memphis and people called the police on him for it. To a lot of people back then, and frankly, even today to an extent, when wrestling is done right, you can get people to believe. So there was that rumor. Lots of rumors about who killed Gino, if he didn't kill himself. Who killed Gino, and how Andre the Giant told people that Gino was shot in the head. He was not shot in the head. That's pretty easily verifiable. He was not shot in the head. Initially, they told his ex-wife, Gino's ex-wife, that it may have been a drug overdose, and the cause of death was listed as acute cocaine intoxication. His mother said that the coroner told her that he had enough cocaine in his system to have killed an elephant. 5 times the amount of cocaine in his system that it would have taken a normal person to OD on. The autopsy report was suspect. It listed him as an uncircumcised male. His ex-wife verified that, in fact, he was circumcised. So there's a little bit of TMI about Gino Hernandez, now you know. And there were other inconsistencies that listed him as Mexican, even though it wasn't. I mean, you could look at that and say, well, the guy's last name was Hernandez. And so if you have an ME that's just not, you know, doing their job, they'll just think, oh, the guy must be Hispanic or Mexican or whatever. But the whole circumcised, uncircumcised thing, you would think that that's something that they could easily check on. And so I don't know why that would have been listed that way. So there were inconsistencies with the autopsy report that gave people a reason to suspect that maybe, you know, things were either being covered up or maybe things weren't investigated thoroughly enough. Can we really, you know, believe in this determination? Jeannie Clark, Chris Adams' ex-wife, described being over at Gino's house once and watching him take a cereal bowl out of the cabinet full of cocaine. And later in the documentary, David Manning admits that the referee he sent over to check on Gino when he found him dead and got into the condo, he also saw what he described to Manning as a sugar bowl full of cocaine. He told Manning that he had never seen so much blow in his life. And out of instinct, he dumped it. Or flushed it, or whatever. I assume that means flushed it down the toilet. Whatever he did. Because the cops did not find any drugs when they got to the home. But that would explain why. This was like a thing with wrestlers, I guess, back then. You show up at the scene before the cops do. You flush the drugs. That's always been the rumor about David Von Erich, right? That Bruiser Brody found drugs in his hotel room in Japan and flushed them before the police arrived. I just talked about that last week. This must have been a thing back then. Must have been an unwritten code. But the man who gave the eulogy at Gino's funeral was this guy, John Royal, was his name. And John Royal, when producers contacted him for this documentary, he had just wrapped up serving a 30-year prison term for trafficking cocaine. They played on this special, the recorded conversations that they had with John Royal. And on the special, he admits to approaching Gino's mother. He says, I did go to her house and I did approach her and told her I was going to pay for the funeral. He denies saying that Gino, or denies the fact that Gino owed him any money. He's not sure why she would have said that. He denies that part of it. But he also revealed that when he was brought up on those drug charges, he was accused of giving Gino basically bad cocaine. And it may have been that bad cocaine that killed him. Now, he said that was fabricated, even though he was accused of that. He said he never did that. That it's not true. But it is telling that, I guess, prosecutors, I guess, thought that that may have been what happened. But anyway, he claims that he was with Gino at a club until 1 in the morning on the night that he presumes that he passed away. He was drinking a lot, Gino was. He assumed that Gino must have been doing drugs as well. He says Gino left with these airline stewardesses, and that was the last time he ever saw him alive. Then, they had a recording from a former drug trafficker, who came forward with his own version of events. He was anonymous. His voice was, you know, dubbed over. He did not want to be identified. He wanted to remain anonymous. But they talked to him, and they played the recording for Gino's mother. So we see her reaction on camera. She's crying. She says, "My God, it's been 30 years. Just give me a second here. I've been waiting so long." And they put the headphones on her, these noise-canceling headphones, and they play the recording. And this guy on the tape says, "Look, I've got nothing to lose from coming forward now with my story. If Gino's family has been worried for the last 30 years that something might happen to them, they've been worried for 30 years too long. What happened is that he and Gino had, you know, and a bunch of other guys, they got involved in selling drugs. They were drug dealers. They were dealing drugs. And Gino got hooked on the stuff and got way in over his head. And he thinks it was a combination of drinking a lot and then going back to his apartment and doing cocaine that killed him. He just did too much. His body couldn't handle it. And he dropped dead." And so then, and again, that's not absolute end-all be-all confirmation of anything, but Gino's mother seemed to be relieved hearing that, that she and her family were, you know, no longer did they have any need to feel, I mean, imagine that, living for 30 years, not knowing, thinking your son was murdered by drug dealers, and if you speak out, they're going to come after you and your kids, like, what a horrible way to live your life. And that's, as she said, she can't get those 30 years back that she spent being so paranoid and worrying every morning when she would wake up. But she was relieved to hear this and that they had no, you know, reason to feel afraid. And she thanked the producers. She was very thankful to them. And she said that, "Oh, I feel so good I could go for a margarita right now." I love this lady. She's great. I feel the same. I feel that it was, and look, everybody has their own opinion. None of us know what happened. You could just hear the stories and the facts and, you know, come to your own determination. You know, just like I'm convinced, as much as they want to make it sound, you know, like David Von Erich had some kind of condition that, you know, he got sick and he died in Japan. I think it was a drug overdose. Can I prove it? No, but that's what I believe happened. In this case, I think it was a drug overdose. I don't think he was murdered. I think it was a drug overdose that killed Gino Hernandez. All the signs point to it. I mean, yes, there are some suspect things, but all the signs point to a drug overdose. And a lot of the paranoia that his family and friends describe could probably be attributed to the drugs that he was doing. If he was doing as much of this stuff as they say he was, you know what? I'd be paranoid too. I'd be going out of my mind. I'd be thinking I'm seeing people in the backseat of my car, looking out my window, you know, watching me everywhere I go. The reason he was so freaking paranoid probably had more to do with his drug habit than anything else, than anybody actually being after him. I mean, you had two different people in this documentary describe him keeping a giant bowl of cocaine in his apartment. If you keep a giant bowl of cocaine in your apartment, you may have a drug problem. Although, if he was also selling it, then, you know, that may be another reason to keep a lot of cocaine sitting in a giant bowl in your apartment. But, you know, I wouldn't know. So I thought this, it was a very compelling documentary to watch. Especially the recorded conversations from the drug traffickers and the drug dealers that they played. And his mom, like I said, she's the star of this documentary. She seems like a really sweet lady, and it really sucks that she, for so long, had no real answers and lived in fear. You know, that's just a shame that it was all those years wasted worrying over nothing. The other thing that's revealed, and this was not in the special that made the air on TV. This was sort of like a deleted scene, a bonus scene that got cut, but they did post it online. I saw it on Twitter. It might be on the Viceland YouTube channel as well. I'm not sure, but there's been another rumor about Gino for a number of years. The rumor being that he was actually the son of Paul Bosch, the famous Houston wrestling promoter, who treated Gino like a son and, you know, promoted him. And some people say that, you know, in his younger years, Paul Bosch physically resembled a young Gino Hernandez a lot. And so people thought that he was his illegitimate son. And we now have an answer to that question. So Luis Hernandez was a wrestler. He was Gino's stepfather, which is where he got the Hernandez name from. That is not his birth name. That is not his given name. His birth name was Charles Wolf. Gino's father left before he was even born. And his mother confirms that Charles was his real father, not Paul Bosch, which, again, had been the rumor for decades. As you know, she would know. His mother said, "I didn't even know who Paul Bosch was, and I was 16 when I had him." So it could not have been Paul Bosch. It was not Paul Bosch. And she said that Gino's real father reached out to her after he saw the announcement in the paper that he had died, and he saw the name Charles Wolf. Only then did he realize that Gino was his son. You know, when he saw him listed by his real name. The crazy part about it is, not even so much that the father saw the name and you know, called Gino's mother, but he was working as either a police officer or a security officer, at the matches, at the wrestling matches, every Friday night at the arena where Gino would perform. And he would see Gino among all the other wrestlers, but he never put two and two together that that was his son. That was his own son. He never knew. And so then once he found out, after the fact, he reached out to Gino's mom. So that's crazy, but there's no longer any debate about that. So I guess there's one question answered, at least, that people can get some closure on as far as who the daddy was. And it was not Paul Bosch. There is one episode left in this season, and it is about the Fabulous Moolah. I watched it the other night. I'm not going to give too much away here, but they interview Moolah's daughter, her one daughter, people who stand up for her and want to restore her good name. And also they interview people, including Wendy Richter, who talk about all of the nasty things that Moolah did and the not so nice side of the Fabulous Moolah and how she held women's wrestling back from what it could have been for a good 40 years out of selfishness and greed. So I think on the whole, it covers both sides pretty well. It's not a hit piece on Moolah. It does not come off as a hit piece on her. I think that it's pretty balanced in terms of you get people arguing for her, you get people arguing against her, including some former lady wrestlers who trained with her at her compound that she had, her school, whatever you want to call it. But I am sure this is going to ignite this Moolah controversy all over again. So give it a few days once this thing airs and you'll see. This whole controversy is going to be reignited again all over again after what happened last year when they took her name off the WrestleMania Women's Battle Royal. But it is a very good special, and I sincerely hope, as well as they seem to have done so far ratings-wise for Viceland, that they will greenlight a season 2. I know the producers have said they already have some ideas. They've already started working on an episode on Dino Bravo. Bring it on. I want more. I thought they did a great job with this series. Even if you're not coming away from every episode feeling like you've learned so many new things, and in some cases I did learn some new things, but just the way they put them together and the way they inform the general audience who probably knows nothing about a lot of these stories, I think is a great thing. And so yes, I want to see a special on Dino Bravo, and I want to see one they were thinking about doing on Adrian Adonis and his death. I think specials on, you know, Benoit and Owen Hart are probably specials that are That would be a given in future seasons. And here's one more I'll throw into the pile because I think it would be tailor-made for a special like this, and that is on the death of Nancy Argentino. Just this week, it was 36 years ago this week that Jimmy Snuka murdered his mistress. A lot of questions about that. A lot of questions about a potential payoff. People looking the other way. I sure would love to hear more about that. So there's another idea for a future Viceland special. Let's get to your mailbag questions. You can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. When you write in, Rex in Houston, Texas. Most opinions I've heard have labeled the wildcard rule as desperate and nonsensical. But what if that's the point? Could this be the first step in a longer storyline that Vince McMahon has lost his mind, leaving the other McMahons fighting over his removal? Well, I mean, look, anything's possible. Do I think it is? No. I don't think it is. Because I don't think they look at it that way. I think Vince, as he said on Monday, looks at it as, well, I'm a genius. I'm brilliant. I'm not out of touch or old or outdated or out of my mind. It's a brilliant, genius idea. It's an ego thing with him. It's all about ego. But I do think, I pitched the idea before, I think that one of the few ideas, if done right, that they could go with, that could, if it was actually kind of put into practice on some level, could have great benefit for the show, would be to have some kind of a power struggle where Vince thinks that he's still the end-all be-all and doesn't think very highly of his son-in-law to sort of take over the reins. And there's this power struggle basically between Vince or the Vince faction of people behind the scenes, whoever that might be, and Triple H and Stephanie. And it leads to some kind of a match where they each have a surrogate, because I don't need to see Vince in the ring against anybody, let alone Triple H. And in the end, Triple H wins out in the power struggle, and Vince, not only in storyline, steps aside, but maybe uses that as an opportunity in reality and in practice, behind the scenes, to step away from creative, and it's sort of the ceremonial handing of the role, or handing of the reins over to Triple H, to give him the ability to run things. See how he does. So I think some kind of power struggle storyline would be a great idea. Do I think this is the beginning of it? No, I have no faith in that whatsoever. I think they just are desperate to come up with some idea to get the numbers back up because they don't know what they're doing. And this was his brilliant idea this particular week. Next week, he may have a totally different idea. He may blow the whole damn thing up and come up with something totally different. Do I have faith that it's part of a long-term vision? No, I don't think there is any long-term creative vision at the moment, which is kind of the problem. Ryan from Ackworth, Georgia, I am really looking forward to AEW, but if they have a working relationship with New Japan, I'm assuming they do, if Jericho is wrestling for them, won't it pretty much be the same as it already is? There is no working relationship between AEW and New Japan at the moment. Jericho, he signed a contract, he signed a deal that allows him to negotiate his own matches, his own deal with New Japan Pro Wrestling, completely independent of AEW. AEW is not loaning Chris Jericho to New Japan. Chris Jericho made that deal on his own with Ghetto or whoever over there to come in and do the match that he's doing with Okada at the Dominion show. That was a deal made between Jericho and New Japan, not AEW and New Japan. And if they do reach a working agreement together, which I would love to see, I don't know what you mean when you say that wouldn't it be the same as it is now, because my hope and expectation would be that you would get to see people like Tanahashi and Okada and Naito and Ibushi wrestling for AEW, which they're definitely not doing right now. So if they reach an agreement, that's what we would get to see. That's pretty different than what we have now. So I don't know quite what you're talking about. David from San Leandro, California. I was listening to Conrad and JR's latest podcast, and Jim Ross said that Steve Austin refused to work with Mark Merrow at Madison Square Garden the night of the curtain call. This is not the first time I've heard Austin refusing to work with another talent and putting them over. I've heard stories about Triple H, The Rock, Billy Gunn, and Jeff Jarrett, among others. Top guys like Hulk Hogan and Shawn Michaels had the bad reputation of not putting others over and would get called out for it. I'm a huge Austin fan, but feel he gets a pass for this from fans and other wrestlers. Do you think my assessment is far off? Or do you agree that Steve Austin tends to get a free pass for this? Hopefully I am making sense. I've gotten little to no sleep since my wife and I are expecting our new baby boy to arrive soon. Well, congrats on the new baby. I'm not sure if he's arrived yet or not, but you'll be having many more sleepless nights, I can promise you that. And yeah, I think he does get something of a free pass from people who criticize other names, like the ones you mentioned, without ever mentioning Austin. I think that's fair. But I gotta correct you. Are you sure that he was referring to the night of the curtain call? Because to me, that really wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, Austin worked with Mark Marrow at the King of the Ring the following month. Actually, I think he had another match with him on the following pay-per-view, the International Incident Show in July. So they worked together quite a bit around that time in the middle of 96. He had just started with the Stone Cold name. He just switched over to the Stone Cold name around that same time. I don't think Austin at that point was in any position to dictate who he would and would not face. I thought the story was that he got to the building one night at a live event while he was the champion. So this would have been in 98. And he found out that he was working a match in the middle of the show with Mark Marrow. And this would have been, I think, I want to say a week or so after Sable had given Marrow the Sable Bomb on TV, which killed his career dead at that point. Austin saw it the same way. And he got to the building and he sees that he's working with Marrow. And in the middle of the show, no less, supposedly because they wanted to, you know, give him time to leave early to get to wherever the TV taping was the next day or whenever it was. Jim Cornette tells the story, actually, in one of his timeline shoots. Austin was supposed to wrestle Marrow, again, the week after, and he's basically said, nope, that's not happening. He got powerbombed by a 100-pound woman on TV. Why am I wasting my time with this guy? And the match never happened. And you know what? He was right. He was right. That match should not have been anything but kick wham stunner in about 10 seconds. You know, Stone Cold getting, here's the thing, like, the idea that Mark Marrow is going to be powerbombed, let himself be powerbombed by Sable. And it's not like Sable was like this great women's athlete, like she was Ronda Rousey or somebody like that. She wasn't. And she was 110 pounds soaking wet. And he let her powerbomb him on television in front of the world. And Sable, you know, she was a huge star. She ended up being a huge star and everything. But, you know, the idea that Stone Cold, as hot as he was at that time, if we're talking about 98... would have said, okay, yeah, I'll work with Mark Marrow, and it was going to be anything other than like a 5 or 10 second squash. He's kind of right. He really didn't have any business being in the ring with this guy and selling rest hold submissions from the guy who got powerbombed by Sable. Would have been a dumb idea. But still, you know, it's what his boss wanted, and he refused. It's not like Vince McMahon was saying, I want Austin to work with Marrow and put him over. I mean, then I would have walked out. And Stone Cold has a history of doing that. But, yeah, so at the end of the day, though, I mean, he was told to do something, and he refused. And he also didn't want to work with Jeff Jarrett for any number of reasons that have been cited over the years, some by Austin himself. But there are a lot of people who believe it had to do with heat that he still had with Jeff and his father from the crappy payoffs that he got when he worked for them in Memphis. He was getting paid so little that he was, you know, barely eating, and it was... you know, ridiculous. At the same time, Jeff was the promoter's son. He didn't have to go through those same struggles. And so there's a lot of people who feel Austin never forgot that. And he still harbored a lot of heat and a lot of ill will towards Jeff and his family for those days. But there's also a few other things you got to remember here. And Austin, these are the ones Austin himself has talked about. When Jeff came back to WWE in 1997, he came out, he did that worked shoot promo on Raw, right? He was in his, it was like a beige blazer or something, ponytail. He comes out there and he's cutting this work shoot promo on a bunch of different people, including Austin. And he goes off on, you know, the Austin 316 catchphrase. And he says it's blasphemous what this guy is doing. And he's selling merchandise and making money off this stuff that has 316 on it. And nobody told Austin that Jarrett was going to say this. So Austin's hearing this for the first time in the back as this guy, his first night in, who he already probably doesn't like, is calling him out and calling his catchphrase and his merchandise blasphemous. And so Austin is pissed off, and he's waiting there, and as soon as Jeff comes back through the curtain, he, yeah, again, first night back, he pissed off Steve Austin, Austin corners him and says, look, that's my merch money that you're putting at risk there with those comments. And he was not happy about that. So there's that. And, you know, he just didn't think Jeff was a big enough star. So he just outright refused to work with Jeff Jarrett whenever it came up. And I think Russo wanted to do something with him and Austin sometime in the summer of 99. Russo was always a big fan of Jeff, even it carried over even into WCW, where he put the championship on him. And then Russo, of course, also worked for Jarrett for a time in TNA. So there was always a friendship there between Russo and Jarrett, but Austin just outright said, I am not working with this guy. Plain and simple. So that's another example. There's, of course, the famous night that Austin walked out in 2002 when Vince McMahon had told them they wanted him to do the job for Brock Lesnar in a King of the Ring qualifying match on Raw. Austin was already fed up with creative at that point, and he had other issues in his life going on. He's talked about this before. His head was not in the best place. But then he was being asked to lose to the new guy in a Raw match with no promotion. And when that happened and he couldn't change Vince's mind, he said, well, I'm not doing it. He took his bag and he went home. And look, another situation where I can't say that I blame Austin for feeling that way and for being upset, because it really was a stupid idea to blow the first Stone Cold Brock Lesnar match unannounced as a qualifying match on Monday Night Raw. That's a pretty stupid idea. But they were all in on Brock Lesnar at the time and building him up. I mean, they did have Hogan lose to him on TV before SummerSlam. And then, of course, Hogan had this thought in his head that, well, I'll lose to Brock as long as I can come back at Survivor Series in Madison Square Garden and win the championship from him. And there's no fucking way that was happening. So that's why Hogan went away and didn't come back until the following year. There's always got to be something in it for these guys. Hogan did the job, but there was a catch. And when he didn't get what he wanted, he went home. He didn't come back until, well, I guess it was until February of the following year is when he came back and he wrestled Rock and then he wrestled Vince at WrestleMania. So that was a stupid idea. Austin has admitted that walking out the way he did was really dumb. It was the worst professional mistake he's ever made in his life. He lost a lot of money. And even when he came back to WWE, Vince McMahon said, look, I have to fine you. I can't just have people walking out and not paying a price for it. And Austin was, you know, they talked about this when McMahon was on the Stone Cold podcast. And Austin said, well, shit, son, you know, what are you going to fine me? What do you think is the number? And Vince said, $650,000. Austin said, God damn, that's a lot of money. You know, and I think he countered with maybe $250,000. And I think the fine ended up being $250,000. That's a lot of money out of Austin's pocket. So he looks back on that and says, that was the biggest mistake I ever made. But at the same time, he ain't wrong in thinking that that was a really dumb idea. The stories of him not wanting to put over Triple H at SummerSlam in 99. So, you know, he lost to Mick Foley. They made it a triple threat and he lost to Mick Foley instead, who then dropped the title to Triple H the next night. I think that honestly had more to do with not having the governor of the state, who happened to also be the referee that night, Jesse Ventura, raised the hand of the heel. Even though Jesse was a heel for, you know, all of his in-ring career, pretty much. But he was the governor of the state. They didn't want to end on a sour note like that. And so they had Foley win. And instead, they used him as a transitional champion to get the belt onto Triple H 24 hours later. I mean, look, Austin lost to Triple H 2 months later. They had a No Mercy pay-per-view. They had a one-on-one match. It wasn't even a triple threat. This was one-on-one. And he pinned Steve Austin. So it's not as though, I don't necessarily buy into that whole story that Austin didn't want to do the job for Triple H. Well, then what the hell happened in those 2 months after SummerSlam that changed so much that all of a sudden Austin agreed to do a singles job to Triple H? It doesn't make sense. So I tend to buy more into the Ventura story as being why they did what they did and not being a case where Austin refused to put anybody over. You know, I don't really buy into that. But look, did Austin look out for himself like those other guys did? Of course he did. Absolutely. Hell yes. He was protecting his spot. He was paranoid. By his own admission, he was a very paranoid person back then. Put yourself in his position. You're the top guy in the business. There was nobody for that brief stretch hotter than Stone Cold Steve Austin. And so you're thinking, there's going to be people left and right looking to knock me off my perch here. He was paranoid. But when you're as hot as he was at that time, you can do that sort of thing, I guess. And people tend to be a lot more forgiving, which is why people tend to give him a pass. But you're right. He shouldn't get a pass. Steve from Virginia, do you think the Superstar Shakeup should be a month-long event since superstars seem to be moving from brand to brand all the time? I think the Superstar Shakeup should not be an event at all if they're not going to take their brand split seriously. I think they should just junk the whole thing. James from Staten Island, I've heard from the Defenders, as I'm sure you have, that Vince McMahon is a genius and we're all just marks. But I'm now being told that my gripe with him for the treatment of the NXT talent is unfounded because Vince McMahon himself is responsible for the creative on NXT, and that the performers who get called up and go nowhere just aren't good enough. What do you have to say about that? Well, first of all, it's just factually incorrect. I don't know what orifice these people are pulling that from, that Vince McMahon is the overseer or creator of creative for NXT. I mean, I think those people need to get their heads examined. That's what I think. Obviously, they're just trolling. I doubt he could even pick half that NXT roster out of a lineup if you put them in front of him. He's booking creative for NXT. Yeah, go get your head checked. Mark in Indiana, with the Raw and SmackDown shows getting worse each week, many fans believe Vince McMahon needs to step away from creative and Triple H needs to take over. Do you think Triple H is the savior that fans think he can be? Are fans misplacing hope in him as the one who can right the ship? They might be. There is no guarantee that Triple H is going to take over and suddenly things are going to be, you know, a bed of roses, or they're going to be like NXT every single week. NXT is a great show most weeks. It's a competent show. It's an easy show to follow. It's usually just under an hour. Things make sense. Things build to things. There's some great matches. You know, every now and then you'll get a stinker of a match, or you'll get a show that really isn't all that exciting. But, like, again, it's a competent, usually fun, easy show to follow. Now, doing that for 3 hours is not an easy thing to do. So if Triple H is in the Vince McMahon position now of having to book creative for Raw and SmackDown every single week, I do think that people who have this idea in their heads that everything's going to turn around and things are going to be so different, maybe they will and maybe they won't. You know, things don't work the same on the main roster as they do with NXT in terms of how they produce their shows and in terms of who gets over and which characters get over and which ones don't. Triple H could just as easily take over and do worse. We might be begging for Vince McMahon to come back. That would be awful if that happened. I mean, I can only imagine how bad that must be. But so yeah, there is no guarantee. I think this notion of Triple H being the savior has to be put aside. I just want somebody in that position who is going to bring a fresh perspective, who has, and preferably as he does, has some documented history of being able to, you know, run creative for a show that is largely very good and makes sense and helps build people and build stories and build stars. And Triple H has that with NXT, but NXT is a very different beast, and it's a lot less TV time than he'd have to worry about filling on a Monday. I really, truly don't believe that we can ever have a hot string of truly excellent, start-to-finish enjoyable Raw shows ever again as long as it stays in the three-hour format. You may have your one-off show here and there where you turn around and you're like, wow, that was a really good show. This notion that we will one day get back to a point where the show every single week is going to make sense and going to be great and going to keep me on the edge of my seat for maybe not all of the 3 hours, but maybe 2.5 of those 3 hours. I honestly don't think it's possible. I really don't think it's certainly not with the people they have writing the show now. It is not possible to have that unless the show is cut back to 2 hours. And with the current crew, then you're just cutting it back from 3 hours of shit to 2 hours of shit. So either way, I still would like to see somebody fresh and new, which Triple H kind of would be, I guess, get the chance. Give him the chance. You're at a point now where what the hell do you have to lose? you have reached nearly rock bottom here. What do you have to lose? You don't trust the guy? He married into your family. This guy's life is wrestling. He's running an entirely different brand. I don't know if it's making money officially now or not, but there's a lot of people who were big fans of that NXT brand who swear by it and wish that, you know, some of that would rub off on the main roster. He's the guy overseeing it. Triple H is not putting pen to paper and writing all the shows himself, but it's his vision. He's supporting that vision. Maybe he brings his own team of people in, and it can, you know, he tries to replicate that same model where he's not the one who has to come up with all the ideas. He can't be. He can't have one person who's coming up with the ideas for everybody. But to use that sports analogy I was using earlier, you change the coach, you change the manager. They have a different playbook. They have a different philosophy. They have a different vision. Sometimes that's all it takes. So I'd like to see it, but I do think people have to also be realistic about this. Triple H is not going to walk on water. You know, I mean, he's not a magic man. He's not a miracle worker. And I think people need to temper their expectations, but I think it's a change worth trying. Let's see here. We've got Eric from Illinois. I have an interest in giving reviews for wrestling shows. Do you have any tips for writing a good review? Should I break down how each match went? Do I keep it short and simple? Talk about what I liked and disliked. What should I do? Well, you're talking about writing reviews, so I assume you're talking about it not as a podcast, but as like a columnist or something. It really depends on who you're writing for. I mean, if you might be writing for a website where your job is to be as descriptive as possible. I don't know who you're writing for or what the rules are. So some people who write for some of these wrestling websites have to give as much detail as possible. That's what people want. That's what people expect. In other cases, I think it's perfectly fine to include your thoughts and editorialize. Sometimes it's completely inappropriate to do that. Sometimes people don't give a shit what your views are. They just want you to report on what happened. Blow by blow, segment by segment, move by move. And that's usually that night or the next day or 2 days later. You know, maybe people haven't watched the show, or they did, and maybe they want your perspective on it. I can't really tell you what to do because I don't know who you would be writing for. If this is your own personal blog, it's up to you, dude. You do you. Whatever you feel is the best way to go about doing it. I would think in that situation, you want to include some opinion in there. Opinion is an easy way to get people talking. Especially if they disagree with you. And you want to be descriptive, but I don't really see the need to go move by move, blow by blow. I even intentionally go out of my way to try to do less and less of that in my own reviews for Raw and SmackDown. In part because, number one, I'm doing my show so late in the week, nobody gives a fuck, you know, what hold Ricochet used on Bobby Roode 6 or 7 days after it aired on TV. But what they do care about, for some reason, is my thoughts and my opinions on what happened in these key segments and these key matches a week ago, especially the ones that are going to impact the show next week that they're going to watch. So if they did something really good, I'm going to talk about, man, this match rocked. And I don't have to sit here and tell people, hey, he did this move and it transitioned into this hold and this was a near fall and this and this and this and this and this. I don't have to do that. All I have to do is tell people, here's why I thought the match was great. Here's one or two key highlights or spots or botches or whatever. Here's what happened at the end. And then I give my opinion afterwards about what I thought about it, or where I think it's leading, or what I think they should do, or what I'd like to see. And then I move on to the next segment. People don't need the blow-by-blow analysis all the time. You give them some details, you give your opinion, and you move on. You know, sometimes short and simple is the way to go, but unless I know who you're writing for, I can't really tell you exactly, you know, what you should be doing. Rabat from Derby, England. Which of the following wrestlers do you wish were still alive today to do a shoot interview with Sean Oliver? You can only choose three of this group. British Bulldog, Brian Pillman, Rick Rude, Owen Hart, Miss Elizabeth, Kurt Hennig, and Yokozuna. Of those three, for a shoot with Sean Oliver, I like Sean Oliver's interviews. I think in that format, in that setting, I'd like to see, of those names, Brian Pillman. I think that would make for a very entertaining shoot interview. Kurt Hennig. Everybody talks about Kurt Hennig as this master ribber. He stirred a lot of shit back in the day. In fact, Kurt Hennig is probably the reason why the Bulldogs and the Rougeaus ended up kind of, you know, it was the roll of quarters or whatever that Jacques ended up using on Dynamite Kid. Kurt Hennig was stirring the shit between those two teams, and he probably has as much as anything to do with why they were at odds with each other and almost killed each other. So I think Pillman, Hennig, and Yokozuna. I think Yoko, I don't know, Yoko strikes me as just being this cool, laid-back guy who probably could tell a lot of cool stories. There is one out-of-character interview with him where he just speaks like a normal person that a lot of people have probably never seen before. I don't even know, if you just type in Yokozuna, or like rare interview, or Yokozuna interview or something, it might come up. It was like an interview he did with some random woman for like a TV station or something. In, I want to say 96, maybe. He's very much out of his character. And I just think if you can get that version of Yokozuna for 3 hours doing a shoot interview, telling stories and just, you know, shitting on people he didn't like, I think that would be very entertaining. Zach from West Virginia. Buy or sell on the bigger dream match. Stone Cold Steve Austin versus CM Punk, or Kenny Omega versus Chris Benoit. Two razor-sharp, promo-cutting, anti-authority badasses versus two masters of technicality and intensity that some would call the best of their time. I gotta tell you, I'm sure at one time that would have been a great wrestling match, you know, Omega and Benoit. The thought of that as a match has never even crossed my mind. I'm buying on Stone Cold and CM Punk, and I'm selling on Jericho on Omega and Benoit. You know, to me, Omega and Benoit would be a great wrestling match. You can get so many great wrestling matches now from so many different combinations. That one does not stand out above all else to me as any kind of dream match. Austin and Punk at one time, maybe not right now, but you know, 10 years ago, let's say, would have been, I think, if built up properly, just on promos alone, would have been a huge match. Absolutely gigantic. Because it's the return of Stone Cold Steve Austin, you know, in a big WrestleMania match. You can almost put anybody in there, and it would have been a big deal no matter what. Punk at that time was also a big name in WWE. Not mainstream or anything like that, but I mean, who really was at that time? And Austin versus Punk, left to their own devices, kind of like Jericho and Michaels were in 2008, to build up their own feud in their own big WrestleMania match, it would have been huge. So, yeah, I'm buying on that. St. Clair from Los Angeles. St. Clair has started his own wrestling career. I've been following along in the little clips he posts every now and then on social media. So, keep doing your thing, brother. He says, I know you've done commentary for a few wrestling shows, but if offered, would you ever be a guest manager for a show or maybe even get physical? Sure. Sure, I'd consider it. I think it could be fun. See, I would keep things simple with my client, though. You do all the work, and I'll take my 30%. Like a true manager. Chris, in Cortland Manor, New York. And we'll end with this. On a recent episode of The Sound Off, you mentioned how you thought Okada was the best in the world right now in wrestling, and I agree with you. I attended the G1 Supercard at MSG, and the arena popped for him like no other. If the day comes where Okada decides he's done all he can do in New Japan, and he wants to take a shot at success in the US, putting aside your pessimism of WWE, at what WWE has done with its talent, do you think he could succeed in WWE? Not just the hot NXT run, but achieve main event status on the main roster. Well, you say put aside my pessimism for how WWE handles some of this talent. That's kind of ignoring the entire issue, isn't it? I mean, if I put my pessimism aside for what they've done with some of these guys like Nakamura, or the way that they kind of give up on some of these people too quickly, that's to ignore the whole issue I would have with Okada coming to WWE. Because I think it would be just another Nakamura situation. Although, Nakamura deserves some of the blame for that as well. Because there were a lot of matches he had, frankly, that weren't overly exciting when he was promoted to the main roster. He had some real gems on the NXT roster with Sami Zayn and Finn Balor. And there was something that felt like it was lacking with his matches on the main roster. So you can't just put that all on Vince McMahon. But they, you know, look, Nakamura was brought in with a lot of fanfare. And you look at where he is now. He is just firmly embedded in the middle of the card. And I don't really see that changing. And in New Japan, he was one of the top names. Okada is the top name. He's the top dog in New Japan. Him coming to WWE, could he be successful? Yes. Of course he can be. I would have said the same thing about Nakamura. But your question is, can he achieve main event status? Well, I mean, so did Nakamura. He's not in the main event now. You can't say he didn't achieve main event status. For a while, he did. And I think Okada would probably get that same chance. But I think that, you know, I think in Vince McMahon's brain, there's just this idea that he is foreign. He doesn't speak the language fluently enough to my liking. It's like the whole Cesaro. Well, maybe he didn't get over because he's Swiss. Yeah, maybe he didn't get over because you have Swiss cheese for brains. Maybe that's why he didn't get over. So he's already going to be fighting an uphill battle if he were to come in, because he's up against that. That's a real thing. That's a real challenge that he would have. No one's doubting his in-ring ability. He is one of, if not the best in the world, in my opinion. And certainly, if you don't think he's number one, unless you just completely just like to shit on anything non-WWE, I don't see how you can even argue that he wouldn't be in the top three, you know, in the world at the moment. So could he be a main eventer in WWE? Of course he could. Could he maintain his main event status in WWE? That's the bigger question. And I can't ignore the pessimism I have. I'm going by history and what we've seen before and what I know to be true. And I don't see him being able to succeed long term as a headliner on the main roster in WWE. I don't see it. I don't think he would get the chance. Not as long as Vince McMahon is the showrunner and he is pulling the strings and controlling things on these shows. I don't think he would get more than just a few matches on top before he would end up in the middle of the card just like Nakamura. And that's not what I want to see from him. That's his home. It would be weird for him to come to WWE. You know, and he could do what he wants. Maybe he'll get bored at some point. He'll want to come, you know, to the States. But I think he's a lifer in New Japan. I think he wants to do all he can to keep New Japan strong as it expands into the U.S., and tries to grow and tries to build. And he's the face of that company like Tanahashi was for a very long time. So I don't even know that he would seriously consider going over to WWE because he sees what's happened. If anything, I would think it makes him less likely to want to take the chance and come over. And we'll see what happens with Kushida. Kushida is not a main event guy. He wasn't. I don't think anybody had any expectations of him coming to WWE, even in NXT and being a main event guy. But a year from now, let's see where Kushida is. And if other people come over, let's see where they end up. I don't even know why Okada would want to take the risk. If you have questions, keep emailing me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. If you email me this week, if we do some mailbag questions on the next show, you might be able to get your question on episode 600. If you don't call in with one. So, make them good. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. Same with the, again, PayPal donations. If you want to send a donation in, and of course, I am very appreciative. Those who do contribute to the show, it's not required. This is not a pay show, but everybody who does, it really does mean a lot to me that you would plunk down however much money it is of your hard-earned cash on the show. And if you would like to do so and get a shout out on our very special live edition of episode 600 this Friday night on YouTube, get those donations in by or before Friday. And you can be part of history with episode 600 next week. Again, it will air live on YouTube Friday, May 17th, 9 p.m. Eastern. And the show will be archived in the hours after it ends on YouTube. And then I will push the audio out to the feed that Sunday. So the show that is airing live on YouTube on Friday will be the podcast for the weekend. What happens after that is a bigger question. I'm not sure because I am flying out to Vegas that Thursday. I will be at StarCast roaming around. I'll be at Double or Nothing and the after party and all that good stuff. And I'm not coming home until late on Sunday. And I'm not bringing all this, I don't have all this equipment to bring with me. I'm not planning on doing any shows while I'm in Vegas. I'm going to try to get some interviews, but there may not be a podcast that weekend. I have to just wait and see what happens. Maybe there'll be one on Memorial Day, you know, the day after. We'll see. I'll keep everybody posted on what's going on. But what I do know is that I will be live on YouTube on Friday night, and I hope you can all join me. 9 p.m. Eastern, Sound Off 600, 600 episodes. And that would not have been possible without your support. So I thank all of you. And again, I wish a very happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there who may be listening to this right now. And if you are not a mom, but you have a mom, make sure that you call her, send her a card, send her flowers, take her out to dinner, whatever the case may be. And make sure that you show them that you appreciate them for all that they've done for you. And, you know, I wish that I could still do the same. Some of us are not able to anymore, and it sucks. I'm not going to lie. It sucks. And so if you are able to still do so, do not miss out on the opportunity to, because you never know what the future may hold. And on that note, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you for episode 600 live on YouTube this Friday night. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Should WrestleMania be expanded to 2 days? Is it time for a 2-day WrestleMania? Fuck no, that's not what needs to be done. We didn't need a 2-day WrestleMania the first 30 years. We sure as fuck don't need one now.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, and more.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster. Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.